I'd like to call this committee to order. Today is Tuesday, May 10, 2011. This conference committee on Senate File 1047. Folks, here's what I'm going to remind you of. We're not on TV, so that's good. But we are just recording, so there is no amplification other than our voices. I think this room is small enough that they should be hear us, but I want you to be mindful, so for some of the folks here inside the committee room will be able to hear us as we discuss this Senate File 1047. So with that, we'll get underway. Of course, we are looking at the language items with no comparable provisions, and we will start, I think, that's been laid out to everyone so they know exactly where we're going with this. So let's start, Mr. Bodern, if we can, with page R2 and donations.
Mr. Chairman, I'm working from that list. Obviously, since these are standalone items, some of them are House provisions and some are Senate only. So I think Mr. Shepard and I, with your permission, will just kind of take turns going back and forth depending on which side of the bill the provision appears in. So I ask Mr. Shepard if you wouldn't mind explaining that House provision.
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, the first House provision on page R2 is on lines 2.26 to 2.30, and this provides that during the upcoming biennium, the House Public Information Office solicits voluntary donations to support its broadcast and print media, and this language would appropriate to the House of Representatives whatever voluntary donations they receive. Mr. LaGrave from the House Public Information Office is here if the members would like more information about the donation program.
That would be fine, Mr. LaGrave. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Barry LaGrave. I'm the director of the House's Public Information Services Office. And as Mr. Shepard indicated, the language does allow the House to keep donations for a voluntary donation program that we have for our session weekly publication and now recently for our video streaming. This is language that first went into law in 2005, so this language has been in effect since 2006. We use it to support the cost to print and mail our session weekly magazine, and we have some limited donations that have come in to support the House's video streaming services. This money is not used for the over-the-air broadcast services. There's no advertising involved. It is just a voluntary donation program. Just to give you a snapshot of the kind of donations we receive, in FY10, we received 124 donations, totaling a little over $2,150. So far in FY11, we've had 79 donations, totaling a little over $1,600. So this language just has been in law since 2005, just allows us for the House to keep these voluntary donations. Once again, there's no advertising involved here. There's no recognition in the magazine or on the video streaming service for those people who provide donations to this service. Glad to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions of the testifier? Anybody want to make a motion that the Senate take part in this and collect half of the money?
Mr. Chair, why are you looking at me?
Well, I know I don't know if there's anyone from the Senate side that wants to comment on this, because I don't believe we do any session weekly anymore as the Senate met. And so... I guess.
Mr. Chairman, appreciate it if you would accept the House position on this so we could continue to do this.
Do you want to make that a motion?
I'll move that we adopt the House language.
Representative Lanning moves that we adopt the House language. Any further discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Motion prevails, by the way. All right, let's move on to page R5. HAVA, Mr. Bodden.
So, Mr. Chairman, on R5, under the in the middle of the page, in line 4.10, this is a rider for the Secretary of State's office that provides an authorization to spend funds in the Help America Vote Act account for the purposes and uses authorized by that federal law. I did want to point out there are two other bills fairly far along in the process here that provide for a different use of the HAVA funds, the voter ID bills specifically. So this Senate provision would be, I think, unnecessary if the legislature wishes to pursue using those funds in a different manner.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vandeveer.
With regard to that, we could say instead of by federal law, by the legislature. Thank you, staff. Would you agree with that on 414? Or do we need it at all?
Mr. Shepherd, may
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, I'm not familiar with the total amount of dollars in the account now relative to the amount that the Senate might have appropriated for other purposes, and the House also has appropriated, Mr. Roberts can help me, but I believe $880,000 in House File 210 from the HAVA account. But so if there were money that was left over after those bills are settled, then if the conferees wanted to make that money available this year, then this language would be needed. If the conferees did not want that money to be available, but instead wanted it to remain in the account, then this language would not be needed, I don't think.
Senator Vandeveer.
I guess in that regard, I would agree with Mr. Shepherd. So, anything I propose, you can forget about.
All right. Anyone here that would like to testify on that behalf? Welcome, Mr. Secretary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Mark Ritchie. I serve as your Secretary of State, and I'm joined by my staff, Beth Frazier. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the hard work you've done with our office trying to put all these pieces together. I did want to speak specifically to the HAVA funds. There's about $2.5 million left in that account. Of course, we're always hopeful the federal government will come with more money, but that does not seem likely in the near future at all. We typically, since 2003, spend about $2.5 million, or about the amount of sum that is left, in our annual maintenance, in our development, in our programs that run our list against the corrections database, the Postal Service database, all the things that we do to keep the list complete. And it's part of our regular budget amount. We would prefer the Senate language appropriating that money. That was also the same language used in the last biennium as well. But it does make up a critical portion of our overall budget, of our total amount. And so for us, it's critical to maintaining our office, but also doing the work that we've promised to do as part of our maintenance of effort with the federal government. So we are certainly understanding and appreciative of the whole process of needing to find savings and to really make this budget work, but we feel that money is necessary as part of our core budget and would favor the Senate language allocating that as part of our overall budget. We need to make our full budget, and this is an important critical component of that. So thank you again, Mr. Chairman, members.
Any questions for Secretary? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I understand the need to keep the funds. I also understand that there are bills that are moving through. And from a position of just making sure that we can maintain the legislators, the money they need for the projects included in their bills, and having the legislature having control over those funds, I'd be more inclined to leaving it out for right now. and not incorporate it into.
Okay. Other discussions? Representative Lanning, do you have a position on this? What are your thoughts?
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that we need to make sure we're covered following the law that the federal government provides. But we also need to give the legislature some freedom and flexibility here. And it seems to me, even if we didn't have this language, Mr. Secretary, we still have obligations under federal law that we must meet, correct?
Correct. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative Lanning, that's absolutely correct. We've signed maintenance of effort agreements, and if we would decide to no longer meet those agreements, we would need to return the full amount of that we've received for them over time. So, we've made that obligation, and it's a fairly strict one. So, the end result would be that the entire burden of the cuts would come out of the business services side, which is the part of our operation that actually puts money into the general fund. So, like the other agencies, we're trying to figure out how to make our operation work well to serve the citizens, to keep the money flowing into the general funds, but figuring out how to do that with a cut, but a cut that we can handle, not one that's beyond what we're able to handle.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if counsel from either the House or Senate could clarify. My understanding was the Help America Vote Act funds could be used for photo ID because it's a related issue. I just want to make sure that that's the case. I think that I'm okay not adopting this at this point. We always said we could add it later if we needed to.
Mr. Bodern or
Mr. Chairman, I haven't worked on that legislation directly this year, but I know that's been the topic of conversation as the photo ID bill has made its way through the process, and I believe there are those who interpret the restrictions provided under federal law to include the purposes for which the money is being used in that bill.
Thank you. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. And this is a question that's come up several times. And Senator Nelson asked this question in one of the finance committees, I believe, and maybe it was a transportation committee. Anyway, she asked the question. We've responded in writing that the Help America Vote Act funds can only be used in accordance with the state plan, which was originally adopted in 2003. It's been amended a couple times, but is primarily the original plan. And the plan allows for talks about spending on programming the statewide voter registration system, which is a part of those bills. It talks about voter education, which is a part of those bills. But it does not talk about many of the other aspects that need to be paid for under those bills. So that the answer is that the Help America Vote Act funds under the state plan and in accordance with federal law could be used for some of the costs, but not all of the costs that would need to be incurred under those bills. And we are required under the Help America Vote Act to continue to meet its requirements and will not receive the funds if they are not appropriated to us, which means we would need to continue to meet those requirements out of our general fund appropriation. There were several bills passed by the last legislature requiring additional list matching, in particular that were reliant upon us having and using Help America Vote Act funds to do the programming necessary. And without those funds, it will mean, as the Secretary said, further cuts to the business services side. Cutting and basically not appropriating this $2.5 million to us is an additional 18% cut to our budget.
Thank you. Representative Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, my recollection is that the statewide HAVA plan did not have to be approved by the legislature. Can you just confirm that for me?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, no, the plan did not have to be approved by the legislature. It was put together by an advisory committee with Secretary of State Kiffmeyer and went through a public comment process and was published in both the state and federal registers.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then I apologize for just some of these background questions. I probably should know this. But do you, in appropriating the Help America Vote Act funds, which comprised the federal component and a state match when they were originally populated, when they were originally put into the fund. You don't have to come back to the legislature for those purposes, or do you actually have to, in your biennial appropriation and budgeting process, confirm the purposes and the expenditures of the HAVA funds?
Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, if I understand your question, the funds have to be appropriated to us each biennium for us to use them. Otherwise, we don't have access to them, and they'll just sit there waiting to be appropriated at some future date.
Representative Downey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so then my question, my ultimate question is, this maintenance of effort agreement that you signed, did the legislature have to approve that? And I'm curious, what is in this maintenance of effort, and kind of what financial commitment has the state made or your office made by virtue of that maintenance of effort? I'm trying to give it in annual dollars or something, and do we have the money to pay for the maintenance of effort?
Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, the maintenance of effort was a condition of receiving the HAVA fund. So it was agreed to in 2003 by Secretary of State Kiffmeyer and Governor Pawlenty, and to a certain extent by the legislature, because it also required a state match. And so the legislature appropriated funds for the match, and the governor signed an agreement saying that we had met the requirements and were eligible for the Help America Vote Act funds. Basically, it requires the state to continue to spend at least $1.925 million in state funds on election administration each fiscal year. And so the first $1.925 million of our general fund appropriation is what we consider that appropriation and is used towards for election purposes. We can't cut that, so any cut to our budget basically falls on the business side of our office.
Representative Benson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Knowing that we're going to conference the first photo ID bill, I would really like to see us hang on to this these funds for a while, and we've got a little bit of time here, and I know that the that conference committee will begin meeting shortly. And if we could, I'd really like to see us not make a decision on inclusion tonight. If anything, just leaving this to another time or omitting it so that we don't have to bring it up right now.
Sure. Representative Lanning, that was my thought, just based on the bills that are out there, that we pass over this for a bit at this time.
I think that's a reasonable request. From my understanding, there would be costs that might be incurred with the photo ID bill that could be legitimately paid for out of these funds. But in the discussion we've had so far in the House, we've clearly understood that there are other things that need to be done with this money. And you can't drain it. You can't take all of it and divert it to some other purpose. So I'm sympathetic to the Secretary of State's concern here about making sure we have funding left over to do some of the other things we have to do. But at the same time, we have the prerogative as a legislature to use some of those or that are legitimately allowed under the law.
Committee, then we'll move on. Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Ms. Frazier, you had one more thing to say?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I just wanted to remind the committee that this is also a redistricting year. And the statewide voter registration system was built after the last redistricting was done and does not currently have the functionality necessary for the counties to update the voter records with everyone's new congressional district and city council ward. And we need to be sure that the programming is there so that these changes can be made. So
right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Committee members, let's move on now to R20, Enterprise Real Estate Property. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, the House position on this issue is on the top of page R20, line 14.31 to 15.7, and it requires the Commissioner of Administration to determine the amount that executive agencies will contribute to maintain the department's enterprise real property technology system. This is something that is a continuation of language that was enacted last biennium, and it was a governor's change item request for this biennium. And I know there are witness people here from the department if any of the contraries would like more information on what this system does.
All right. Do we have any testifiers that would like to come forward? Welcome, and please state your name.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Wayne Wislowski. I'm the Director of Real Estate and Construction Services, and appreciate the support of the members on the Enterprise Real Property System. Our request is actually to carry forward funds from the previous biennium versus what the language currently provides, which is that we have a new assessment to state agencies and would provide for new funding. The state agencies that are working with the real property system have not budgeted for an additional expense, but what we do have is the carry forward from last biennium, and we'd like to continue the work on the real property system just need a language change, which I believe was in the governor's budget bill, to change the end date from out into the next biennium.
Any questions, Representative Downey?
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And what's the status of the implementation, and are all these agencies now using it? And have they retired their old systems?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, good question. We're at various stages of implementation between the different agencies. The Enterprise Real Property System is up and running, so that single database. We still have four legacy systems that are running. The agencies that were utilizing Enterprise Real Property System prior to this initiative. We're just in our migration. Our migration for the Department of Administration is scheduled for this month, followed by Department of Human Services, Department of Corrections, and then Veterans Affairs. With that, we would have all agencies. The system would be available for use by all state agencies. And even within that, agencies are at different levels of their implementation. It starts with the space module, so agencies have to get all of their drawings for all their buildings into the system, and that is the foundational element of the system. Many agencies are using the building operations module, which is the next module. That's the preventative maintenance work order module to track repairs and maintenance on buildings, but that is the progression. You first start with space, and then you build from there.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So what's the end date on 90% of the conversions and cutovers all being done? Are we 6 months away, a year away? How long until everybody's really more or less on the system?
Mr. Wislowski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, I'd say the end of August, everybody would be on the system. What this carry-forward appropriation would do is allow us to get the drawings for most, if not all, the agencies into the system. So that's the AutoCAD drawings that really is the space management module, the foundational piece of the system.
Representative
Downey. Mr. Chair, why wouldn't we start charging back the agencies for this then if we're basically going to be done by August? I mean, I get that you got some conversion of drawings and things, but it seems like everybody's now over on this. We should just be letting the agencies experience a charge back for their respective usage.
Mr. Wislowski.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, there's actually a general fund appropriation, so this is not an assessment-based system right now. We have a general fund appropriation for the system versus an assessment to the state agencies. And again, as I mentioned, the state agencies have not budgeted for an assessment, an additional assessment.
Representative Downey.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think I would just move that we adopt the House language, and I appreciate that's maybe not the wishes of the administration. We did have some discussion of this in committee, and I think this might actually have originated from Representative Kahn. It's one of those cases where we're moving everybody onto a centralized system, and they should probably fairly pay for their respective volumes of usage as compared to continuing to fund it through a general fund appropriation. So I would move the House language, and I guess stay remain open to conversations with the administration if they really see that as some kind of a huge problem.
All right, thank you. Representative Downing moves the House language of 14.31 through, I believe, would that be 15.8? Mr. Shepherd, that's correct. All right, thank you. Is there further testimony on this particular part? Any further discussion from the committee? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Let's move on to our page R25, Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, members, the House provision on R25 deals with the membership of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. This was a bill sponsored by Representative Kahn that was then folded into the House omnibus bill. The provision would increase the membership of the commission from its current 10 to 14, so there'd be 7 from each chamber, with no more than 5 members from each chamber from the majority caucus in that chamber.
Do we have any testifiers on this? Yeah, I'm going to call on Representative Lanning, who just happens to chair the Pension Commission, and get your thoughts on this whole issue.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have supported this initiative. I think I was a co-author, and we supported it in committee. And the reason for it is that pensions are increasingly needing our attention as legislators, and we need to get more legislators actively engaged in addressing the major policy issues that there are. I think it's unfortunate that we got a late start on the commission and just recently started. Senator Daley and I served together, and you know, if the Senate is, I know the Senate has not taken to this idea to this point. I would offer a suggestion, if the Senate still is reluctant, that what we could do is delay the enactment of this until the next biennium. I'm a little concerned about adding people now midstream. We're going to have the first year of the new pension commission behind us before we add membership, and I think you can make an argument that when our leadership appoints people to various boards and commissions, they ought to know that at the time they're making all the appointments, so they can take that into account. So I don't know what I just offer that as a suggestion here, but the House has already passed this, and so we need to represent the House position.
And thank you for that, Representative Lanning. I can tell you that I know on the Senate side, Senator Pappas was the author of the bill. I believe she followed through when Representative Kahn. She was given opportune time to move the bill forward, but for some reason didn't feel the need to. I think the Senate is okay with this, and I guess Representative Lanning, I would agree. You know, it's a big task, and I think the Senate has all the confidence in the world in your chairmanship of the current pension committee. So I still think it needs, because of this daunting task that we have, I believe it needs the membership. But I think we would be okay moving this off, if you would like to move it with an oral amendment to come up with a date, start date of this, and if that's the next biennium, I think the Senate position would be fine with that. I see nods to the affirmatives. So it would be up to you.
Senator Daley, okay with that?
Senator, okay.
Mr. Shepherd, what would be the appropriate language to have it take effect next biennium.
Mr. Chair, if you look on page R25 in the current law, line 18.29 of the House position, it looks like the current law provides for terms to begin January 16th. And so picking up on that, I would suggest on line 19.6 to delete the language that says the day following final enactment and insert January 16, 2013, and then delete lines 19.7 and 19.8.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that provision, that amendment.
Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion is adopted. Let's move on to page R34 and 35, county audits. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, this is a provision from Representative Murray's House File 1063. I believe Senator Daley had a similar provision in the Senate, and it provides for a county. This is on page R35, House language 29.11 to 29.21, that a county can provide for its audit to be performed by a CPA firm. The House language has a couple of sentences that may not be in Senator Daley's bill that requires the county to notify the state auditor before January 1 of a year in which the county is going to have the audit performed by a CPA firm, and then to give notice if they're going to pull back and have the state auditor do it. And then there is language that requires the audit to meet the standards and be in the form required by the state auditor. It allows the state auditor to require additional information as the state auditor deems in the public interest, but requires the auditor to accept the amendment unless it does not meet industry auditing standards.
Do we have any testifiers on this section? If so, please come forward. Welcome, Madam Auditor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have testified on this bill before. We respectfully oppose this provision. Currently, 70% of our office is the audit division, and we have a net neutral impact on the state's general fund because the money that we're given in appropriation, we return. And so this provision actually will create costs for the state's general fund, and which needs to be accounted for. What else can I tell you?
Would you explain that? You say it will create a cost. Could you explain how that would be created?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We provided fiscal notes for as many of these as we could, and Representative Murray's bill got a fiscal note. And for fiscal year 12, there's going to be the assumptions that were made in the fiscal note were that, worst-case scenario, all counties go. So there's kind of a floor and a ceiling. If all the counties were to go private, because we have no way of predicting, worst-case scenario, the state has to cough up $2.297 million in fiscal year 12, and in 13, 14, and 15, it's over $500,000 each year. And that would be created by severance pay, unemployment, all kinds of things. We could get out of leases eventually, but there's those costs. Then what also happens to the counties that are left, let's just say they don't all go, so it's less than that. But for the ones that are left, the audit costs will actually increase. That's part of when the privatization occurred back in 2003, audit costs did go up on counties, because we lost economies of scale in terms of spreading overhead costs over less entities. So this would actually make it worse for the counties that are left, which would not be an incentive for them to stay with us. So we're doing worst case scenario that they are all gone. And then we are not able to perform petition audits when we get petitioned by residents of a community, which we've been receiving quite a few. We can't do request audits when local governments can't find a private firm to audit them. We're not there anymore for that. But anyway, the costs are created by the severance and unemployment and all the costs associated with laying people off. And so we're also not putting in revenue anymore, so you have to cut the revenue side, which I think the Senate did in their spreadsheet. So.
All right, thank you. Any questions for the testifier?
Senator Gazelka.
I know this is really, Senator Daley's, I'm sure it was similar. And when the testifiers have showed us real examples of saving 50 to 100% on their audits, $10,000, $30,000, $40,000 a year, the counties can save. And the counties need to watch the taxpayers' money as well. And I like the budget. I mean, I think that it holds us accountable. If we're going to pass that on to the remaining counties, I really doubt any counties will do a state audit. But I can't imagine charging them as much as twice as much for virtually the same thing.
Thank you, Senator Gazelka. I think we heard compelling testimony in committee, the pros and cons. I think, Madam Auditor, you had some fairly interesting testimony on some of the reasonings of the cost being where they were on your part.
Mr. Chair, can I also provide some clarification? There were some numbers provided by a county finance person. She clarified pretty clearly that it was an informal survey they conducted with a certain number of counties, and they didn't know if they were giving them audit costs on a calendar year or a fiscal year. There's a huge difference. And then they're using it compared to say that on average they save $19,000 a year with private. Those numbers are not reliable, and I really didn't talk much about that the other night, but I do want to bring it to the members' attention. The original spreadsheet that was provided in one of the committees actually was wrong. There were mistakes in it. So we're not 50% more expensive normally than the privates. The other problem is I had a county who is private currently explain to me when they heard this thing was going on, because they were getting legislative staffers calling them trying to get the numbers out of them, that you can't take the numbers and make any conclusions from them, because if a county makes major, let's say when they left us, their audit costs were a certain thing. Well, auditing standards change, all kinds of things change. Their programmatic money changes. The amount of time an auditor has to spend can be impacted greatly by a county and also the money they receive. But they said, but our county has made major investments in my training and my staff's training. We have adequate staff, and we've been able to reduce our audit costs because we're doing so much more. Those numbers are not comparable. And this individual is not interested in getting involved in the fray. But there are issues with the numbers that were presented, Senator Gazelka. And I've done all I can as a state auditor to make sure we're doing everything on our end. It's the county's responsibility. If they're not prepared for us when we walk in to do the audit, and we've been communicating all along and asking them to commit to preparing all these different things that we actually audit, we can't do anything about it. We can support them, encourage them. We've created worksheets for them. But if their county board cuts a staff person who worked on getting things ready, it makes for a less efficient audit. So the numbers presented should not be used in any kind of definitive manner because they're not right. It's very difficult to do a study on audit costs because you have to look at every single entity in their particular situation. And so I would respectfully disagree with the characterization of audit costs.
I'm going to go back to Senator Gazelka first.
Just a brief comment. If the state provides quality service at a fair price, and we adopt this, we have nothing to worry about.
And Mr. Chair?
Madam Auditor.
But you all have something to worry about because it creates costs for the state's general fund. And from what I understood, there was quite a deficit. And so respectfully, what I'm saying is that we have a net neutral impact currently. This provides no relief to the state's general fund. It will actually hurt the state's general fund. So that was just the point that I was hoping to make this evening as you consider the state budget.
Representative Stenzer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know when Representative Murray presented this. I mean, we had quite a number, and I have been emailed particular comparisons between counties, and I think we just have to be careful when the counties say we were paying X, and then when we did an audit with the state, I mean, we can't just discount those numbers. If the counties feel they get a competitive service locally in whatever town or county that they're in, I mean, to say that their numbers aren't reliable because for whatever reasons, I mean, we've got very good people in our counties in local government, and I think we got giving them some level of control is important.
All right. I think Senator Daley was next.
Mr. Chair, Madam Auditor, in the 4+ years that you've been the auditor, how many audits has your organization reviewed?
Madam Auditor?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure what you mean.
There are
Senator Daley?
Mr. Chair, there are about 28 counties that currently have received this waiver. So one could guess that's 28 counties each year, multiply that by 4, give or take. You may not have finished the 4th year because there may be some audits that are still being undertaken. So let's say it's roughly 100, give or take. Is that a fair approximation?
Madam Auditor?
Well, of the process is if a county is receiving a private audit, our staff does some level of review of that audit. Whether we get into the work papers of the audit is another question. That takes more time. And so
my question is, is 100 about the number?
Madam Auditor?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm so persnickety about numbers and I want to get things right. There's a couple more counties that we let go private since I've been in the office, and so it wouldn't be exactly 100. But my staff do what they're supposed to do in terms of reviews of private audits.
So,
Senator
Mr. Chair,
Daley?
I'll ask the question again. Is 100 about the right number?
Madam Auditor?
Approximately?
Senator Daley, I'll get back to you.
Okay. Assuming that 100 is give or take the number, how many of those county audits have not met your standard?
Madam Auditor?
Mr. Chair, none since I've been in, but there was a bad one. There was, let me just preface that. Before my time, there was an audit that was not adequate and had to be reissued. So it does happen. Since I've been around, this is pretty insider information, but have been audits that have not gone well because a firm really doesn't have the skill set to do governmental audits? Yes. And
Senator,
so sometimes counties can figure out that this isn't really working out because they don't really know what they're doing. And so there's been things that have gone bad, yes.
Senator Daley, did you have more?
Mr. Chair, so am I to understand that you are disparaging the local CPA firms, that they're not meeting the standards? Is that what I hear you saying?
Madam Auditor?
No, Mr. Chair. We're an oversight function, and we're charged in statute to do certain things. And part of our job is to review audits that are conducted by private CPA firms. So under the past auditor, when legislation was changed, these are some of the safeguards that were put in place for us to decide at the end of the day if it met the standards or not. Governmental auditing and accounting are very, very different than private sector. And so you need somebody to make sure that things are going right. But we work in unison with lots of private CPA firms. They call our office on a daily basis, and we do assist them. And we provide training. So I've always seen it as a very symbiotic relationship. And whenever I speak at their conference, I always say, we're in this together. You're doing very, very important work, and we do as well, and we do it well together. We support their audit findings. We do a city audit project. We support them. So I'd say we have a great relationship with them in general, but we have a certain function we have to perform when it comes to them auditing counties because the legislature decided it was important for the state. The state had a great interest in county money because some of their money is collected nationwide, and then some of the money is collected statewide, and then some of it's collected locally. So that's why it's in the Constitution, and the legislature felt that that money was really important to have. The state had a great interest in it. So that's why our office is in place, whether it be me or any other state auditor. So.
Further, Senator Dale.
Mr. Chair, I don't have any more questions, but I need to say some things for the record to set the record straight, and that is to insist that our local CPA firms are professional. They have the highest integrity. They have the highest independence. They're every bit as trained and professional as anyone at the state auditor's office, and any implication to the contrary is offensive to any professional CPA. Furthermore, a lot of the training that was mentioned is being done on behalf of the state auditors, who are in many cases brand new folks who go to the counties and don't have a lot of training, and the local counties are training that staff, helping guide them with how to do certain things with the audit. I think this language that is on the House side is most excellent. I think the Senate should adopt the language and do it with haste.
Senator Daley moves to adopt the House language. I know there's more testifiers here.
Mr. Chair, just one more thing, please.
Yes.
This is a may. This does not require the counties to have the audit done. It's not a mandate. It is a may. Many counties have sought this. They're coming to us and saying, could you please put something in the statute so that we can do this? Not don't require us, but allow us, and that's what this does.
Right.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Madam
Chair,
Auditor.
There's currently a process in place, just to clarify for anyone who hasn't heard this yet, where they can ask our office if they can go private. Some of them have gone private and have asked to come back, just depending on what their situation is, where they feel they get the best service. So there's currently a process in place, and I told Senator Daley that the current system seems to be working very well, and I don't know of, you know, all the counties that feel that they have to have it. I heard Goodhue say that they might be interested, but again, they can send us a letter letting us know that they're interested, and we review that. We're reviewing it soon. So there is already a process in place for this to occur, but the difference is that if it's done this way in statute, we're no longer net neutral to your general fund, to the state's general fund. Suddenly, the general fund has to cough up money, which, if you know the numbers, becomes difficult when you're trying to overcome a $5 billion deficit. And so although it might be brilliant policy, it does not help the state's budget deficit. And so I just wanted to point that out again because I don't know you all decide if the state can afford it, but it does cost the state real money, and that's what I wanted to make sure that everyone was clear on tonight.
All right. Thank you, Madam Auditor. I believe there was another testifier.
Mr. Chair, just one final comment.
Senator Daley.
In testimony on the record, we received confirmation from the auditor that we would receive the criteria so that when counties send in this request for the waiver, they would know if they were denied exactly what the reasons were. I have not yet received that.
I'm sure Madam Auditor will get that to you. Thank you, Madam Auditor. Next testifier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Joe Matthews with the Association of Minnesota Counties. Our executive director did testify in support of the House provision in the committee, and we continue to support that provision. I think in response to the previous testimony, the interest from our counties, we have a lot of counties interested, but they're really looking for, I think, some clarity in the process because they don't want to switch from the auditor services to the private sector unless they're going to realize the savings. And I think before they go and bring in a CPA firm, they don't want to say, well, we'd like you to give us an estimate, but, you know, there's this other process we have to go through before we decide to do business with you. I think what they'd like to do is say, we have this option. If you can compete, then we'd like to consider it. And so I think that's the perspective we're coming at it with. I do want to clarify again and actually confirm a lot of what the auditor did say. Her staff does do a good job, and our counties, many of them are planning on staying with the auditor's staff. And again, unless they can see a realized savings, it wouldn't be in their interest as the county board or for their taxpayers to move away from that. You know, finally, I guess if there's any questions, we'd be happy to answer those. But again, this is in no way a reflection of the auditor's staff or the quality of the job they do. This is something that our folks are interested in only as an option.
All right, any questions for the testifier? Thank you, sir. Members, we're going to do two things. We're going to we'll take a vote on the adoption of the language, and then I do know we have an amendment we'll come back with. I would just like to say, as I take a look at this, and I've had a few discussions with Madam Auditor, but I truly believe the direction that this state needs to be looking at this point in time is a downsizing and a move towards the private auditing with the auditor's department becoming the educational arm, the teaching arm, and the overview. And I think we have to be look down the road at how that can be facilitated. And come on up, Madam Auditor. I'll give you I truly believe that we have great people that can do these audits as long as they understand the correct governmental auditing practices. And I think that, in my mind, I think I see that as
the charge of the auditor is to develop a duly elected representative, but I think it's your charge as this technology changes and we're looking at streamlining. Your auditors can do very, very well in the private field because of their knowledge. And I think it behooves us to start moving in that direction long term. And I see this is what right now appears to be just the start of that direction.
And Mr. Chair, you have to have a staff that has a deep understanding of governmental auditing. And this is not taught in the schools. This is actually learned on the job. And if the, you know, for us to be able to do legitimate trainings, we have to have people that are auditing in the field because it changes every year. Every year something new and different, or not multiple things change. And I won't have that staff to provide that service. And if the private firms ever decide that they don't want to do these entities, we're going to be in a whole heap of trouble because my people are gone. And you really have to maintain, I just want to say this because you know how passionate I am about this office, Mr. Chair, and I told the voters that I was going to make sure this function was going to be strong, not reduced. And so I have to be there for those voters that I am representing as the state auditor. And we will not be able to carry that function out, unfortunately. So I just want you to know that not having a viable staff, having all the skill sets they need from, you know, standards, procedures, quality control, the basics of the beginning auditors who know their work and they have supervisors who work with them, to the people that are, you know, completing these audits, it's really, really technical stuff. And that's why the state has such a great interest. And you can't replace it once it's gone. So if the legislature were to choose to do this, I just want you to know that it's a slippery slope to the taxpayers not being well represented because it's fairly grave for the future. It would be hard for us to do what you're hoping for, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to make sure that you understood that.
And I appreciate that, Madam Auditor, mm-hmm. but I also know you're a very creative person and you have good foresight and you think forward. And I think, seriously, the opportunity for you to develop some very good teaching techniques and working and moving forward is what will really benefit this state in the long run. So thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
The Senator Daley moves that we adopt the House language. Any further discussion? If not, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. With that, motion prevails. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The same requirements exist for cities of first class. And on behalf of the city of Rochester, one of the cities that I represent called me because with the latest census data, they became the city of first class. And, of course, they've not been required to go before the state auditor and have a relationship with private auditing firms already, and they want the ability to be able to keep that. So Mr. Shepherd has helped draft an amendment that would allow that to happen, the city first-class city audits that would follow the same direction we just passed and allow them to seek outside audits the same way. So this would also take effect then, of course, for Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, but particularly Rochester. So it would be the city of the first class.
So Representative Benson moves the A42 amendment. Is there any testimony on this amendment? Senator Daley, was this part of your bill?
Yes, it was, Mr. Chair. I'd say this is a friendly amendment, and I don't know if I could speak on behalf of the other Senate members, but if I were, I'd say this is something that we should accept.
And it did pass through committee. All right. Any further discussion on the A42 amendment? Hearing done, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. All right, let's move on, committee, to R3536, legislative liaisons. Mr. Bonner.
So, Mr. Chairman, the
The changes in the language are shown on page R36, and this is a beginning on line 28.20. This is a Senate-only provision. This was added into the same bill that made changes to authorization for deputy and assistant commissioners. And the language you see in subdivision 2, as was shown there, prevents the state agency from using any appropriations for the salary expenses of someone who is serving as a liaison to the legislative affairs of the agency. And then goes on to clarify that the agency can, of course, continue providing information requested by legislators. Mr. Lundin can correct me on this, but I believe the Senate does have, I think there's some anticipated general fund savings from this provision as well.
Mr. Lundin?
Yes, that's correct, and we took that into account with the $302 million on R19 that we talked about last night, and the savings that would result from the legislative liaison positions would be $602,000 from the general fund, and then about $1.3 million coming from other funds.
All right, thank you, Mr. Lundin. Do we have anyone that would like to testify on this part of the bill? We'll take testimony. Committee members, do you have any questions? I'm interested in your thoughts. We're not going to, just because of the dollar connection here, we're not going to take any action. I was just trying to get a sense of the committee members on this. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering, from your standpoint and Senate standpoint, how was it introduced? What was the premise or the background on how it came about? And was it one of your bills? Or
Representative Anderson, yes, it was. It was part of a bill that, with the background that we received in a study done by MAPE, to which that study stated that there was overabundance of middle management. And when we took a look at that on the Senate side, it was included. And for the life of me, I can't think of the bill. Yes, it was Senator Ted Lilly's bill. And so that's where this provision came from. Excuse me on that. I shouldn't say liaisons were part of that. The commissioners were, and we felt that the liaisons should be included in that. So, Representative Benson.
Mr. Chairman, in our discussions, just the value of the liaisons and helping the committee complete their work and having dialogue between the various offices so that we can complete our work I want to be able to point to at least some value there. I'm not sure how well that's gone this session. I know in past sessions that's gone very well, and at least in the conversations that I've had. So just want to raise that in that there has been value. I've experienced myself in the last couple of weeks, probably in some of the bills that we're going to hear yet tonight, in having those folks carry the message that we have back and forth, that we need to have good conversation if we're going to bring results to our conference committees or to our committee's work. So I just want to raise that.
And I appreciate that, Representative Benson. Our concern was that if you want to get right down to the bottom line, we're spending taxpayer dollars having a liaison come and talk to us, when shouldn't that be the commissioner's position? We had Madam Auditor here tonight supporting her department and her side. And that's a tough call, and I understand it. We all like information, but when you're spending those taxpayer dollars to have someone from within come and lobby us, to get more money from us, that we felt was the position that the commissioner should be in. Representative Benson.
I appreciate that position. I'm just thinking of the committee administrators that don't often have nearly the clout to be able to call up the commissioner and say, we've got a lot of things to work out, and this is where the real facilitation comes through. So I understand perfectly, you know, where you're coming from in that, but also I'm also concerned about the process, so that in the future, to find some savings, that we have people that are talking to each other, not below our level, you know what I mean?
Sure.
But where the rubber's meeting the road a lot of the time.
And I can understand that. And if anybody wants to bump into the Secretary of State, he's always knocking at my door to have an early morning meeting so he can have waffles and pancakes up in my conference room. So, and I appreciate that as Representative Lanning, I'll let you chime in, but as a chairman, I appreciate the liaisons, but by golly, we have commissioners that are hired to do a job, and they need to be in front of us. I see Representative Anderson, and then we'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When Senator Lilly presented the bill into your committee, you mentioned MAEP having done a study. Did MAEP actually testify, and what was, or is it just based on a study that you actually were reading?
They really didn't testify. This MAEP had the study on the deputy commissioners, and this we included as liaisons as part of that. We're going to move on this at this time, but Representative Lanning, you have anything that you would like to include?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's a legitimate question for us to discuss. And like Representative Benson, I've had some very positive experience with people who have played that role, government relations, legislative liaison, or whatever. But I've had other situations where I haven't even ever seen the people. And I don't know if anybody has ever systematically done an evaluation. But since they're supposed to be communicating with legislators, legislators ought to have a chance to evaluate whether or not individuals are doing what we expect. They're obviously representing their boss, and we understand and appreciate that, but I think legislators ought to have a chance to at least evaluate.
All right. Well, thank you for the input, committee members. We will have this passed on at this point in time and re-look at it down the road. Let's move on to page R36 and then 47 through 49. Let's go to Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, as you indicated, the next House position relating to state contracting is expressed in several sections, so I'll just review briefly where those are. Beginning on R36, the House provides that each agency head must carry out the agency's duties in the most cost-effective manner possible and has to decide if that is through hiring state employees or contracting with outside sources. That section also provides that if an agency decides to seek an outside vendor, the agency must permit groups of state employees to compete for the business. Mr. Chair, the next provision, and this is all from Representative Downey's House File 192, is on beginning on the very, very, the last line of page R47, but really beginning on R48 and 49, amending the laws to eliminate the requirement that an agency determine that no current state employee is able and available to perform services before entering into an outside contract. The first section on R48 relates to professional or technical services contracts, and turning the page to R49, the same concept is expressed on line 41.23 and 24 in regard to contracts that are not are for professional or technical services, but that are for other services. And Mr. Chair, the last part of the House position from Representative Downey's bill on this is some repealers that are back on page R67. These all relate to the same issue of whether state employees would be available before contracts are issued.
All right. Do we have anyone that would like to testify on this? Welcome. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kent Allen. I'm the Director of the Materials Management Division within the Department of Administration. As Mr. Shepherd indicated, there are a number of elements in this set of provisions. I want to be fairly clear about which ones I am and am not talking about. I'm really talking about a fairly narrow technical issue. I'm not addressing the sort of broad policy that you're looking at here, which involves the issue of the desirability of using state employees versus private sector vendors. That's something that we leave to the policymakers to decide. And I'm not suggesting that it's not appropriate for agency heads to be making determinations with respect to the most cost-effective manner of providing services. But having said that, we believe the language as drafted poses a fairly serious legal risk to the state by requiring agencies to determine and carry out all of their duties in the most cost-effective manner possible. What that does by putting language of that nature in the statute is that it creates a legal obligation to adhere to a fairly subjective goal. Clearly a good goal, but a subjective goal. The problem with that is that the state risks litigation from any interested vendor who believes or chooses to argue that they could offer a more cost-effective service delivery model. Even if the state went through this analysis and privatized or outsourced most of its activities, the state would still be at a legal risk that other private sector vendors who believe they could do the work for even less could raise that issue or could litigate that issue. And again, although looking for the most cost-effective service provider is clearly a desirable objective, doing that exclusively can restrict the state's ability to consider other factors that could be highly relevant. Experience of the vendors, their accountability, their freedom from conflicts of interest. There's a risk that with this language that we will always be seeking the cheapest solution. And I think, as you know, that the cheapest solution isn't necessarily going to be the best one for the state. So we think the way this was drafted, there could be some unfortunate unintended consequences.
Mr. Shepherd or Mr. Bodern, could you maybe address that a little bit for us? I mean, your thoughts on that language?
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I can opine on litigation concerning bid contests. Obviously, this does this provides another criteria that the state would be required to consider when contracting. Mr. Allen is correct in that regard. That someone could raise it as an objection.
Mr. Shepherd, do you know where that might? Or, oh, excuse me, Representative Downey. Yeah,
thank you, Mr. Chair. This is my bill, and I guess a couple of observations, and then I'll maybe make a comment to indicate that I'm willing to work with the department to come up with something that's appropriate and adequate. I think we're hearing a little bit of the classic protectionism, the assumption that cost-effective automatically means cheapest when with regards to outsourcing, I don't think is a fair assertion. It is certainly not an accurate interpretation of my intent. And in fact, state procurement policies have advanced, and I think we're actually getting better and better at doing best value procurements in the state, and that lowest total cost is not the sole determining factor. So I think there's been a fairly substantial overstatement of the implications of the language. The legal implication that perhaps somebody from the outside vendor world could sue the state at any point in time because they aren't outsourcing something. Clearly that wasn't contemplated in the bill, so I'm very glad to work with the department and consult some legal counsel here in the interim and make sure we come up with the right kind of controlling language to make sure that that's not a possibility. Very clearly the overriding purpose of the provision is that right now, state agencies are compelled by statute not to outsource, and this would simply open it up so that they could make a good decision in any respective circumstance they run into that looks like it's an opportunity for outsourcing, that they could go ahead and do that. And very importantly, allow the state employees or the bargaining unit that's currently doing the work to bid on the work as though they were an independent firm unencumbered by state overhead. It's entirely possible that our people, unmoored from the constraints of the bureaucracy, might be the absolute most effective and cost-effective way to get it done. So I think that's the intent of the overall provision, and we can work out the potential legal implications if there are any.
Mr. Allen, does the agency have any kind of language that they've been thinking about here?
Mr. Chairman, any language that would not create the statutory requirement that the state is always using the most cost-effective delivery model, I think resolves the legal risk that I'm raising.
All right. It sounds like Representative Downey is very willing to work on that. So, thank you very much. Any further testimony on this whole section that we're looking at this time? Welcome. Please state your name.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Julie Blyle, Legislative Director for AFSCME Council 5. We are opposed to this language. We've testified in committee in opposition to it. We believe there is a better approach, and that approach would be to follow the example that has been put in statute for the Transportation Department for MnDOT, and that is of utilizing the Taxpayer Transportation Accountability Act that provides a cost-benefit analysis and allows the department to go forward, perform that analysis, and make determinations within the agency. That law was actually signed into law by former Governor Plenty, passed by the legislature approximately 3 years ago. I stand to be corrected on the number of years ago, but is on the books today. We are opposed to eliminating Chapter 16C. We believe that that will do a disservice to the public employees of the state. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, Richard Kajewski with MAEP. We also oppose this language, as we've testified before your committee previous to this. This really eliminates the no current state employee is able and available to perform the service called for by the contract. And, Mr. Chair and members, I don't necessarily think this is the most efficient operation when we may have employees that are already working in government who can do this work that an agency then is going to outsource. I wouldn't call that efficiency by any means. I know Representative Downey wants to open this up for outside bidding and for contractors, and talks about labor unions bidding on these. We rarely in any state agency have a large enough division of any particular job class or classes that would allow us the resources, or in fact we're not set up to even bid on these contracts to begin with. So we certainly don't support this. As Ms. Blyle said, this language doesn't provide for any cost-benefit analysis. And the additional language that's in there that talks about not contracting out if there's an employee who's been laid off in the previous 4 years, more often than not, this is an employee who hasn't been sitting at home for years on end. This is an employee who was recently laid off, an employee that you're already paying benefits for that layoff process, including unemployment. And again, that money's just wasted. These are people who are in your district spending money, working 40-hour plus weeks, constituents of yours. We've heard from the economists talking about a job. These are taxpayers. These aren't people just siphoning off of state government. They work hard for their money. They do good work for the state. And this really opens this up to outsource, insinuating that the private sector can do stuff cheaper and better, because we are not, as a labor union. And I would doubt Ms. Blyle would disagree with me in the sense that AFSCME, despite them being larger in nature, are in a position to bid on any of these contracts. We're not going to.
Any questions for our testifiers? Thank you very much. Any more testimony? Anyone else that would like to be heard? How would you like to proceed, committee members? Which Representative Downey, I know this is yours. I mean, are you interested in trying to move it, or do you want to just set it aside for a bit and come back to it at a later date so you can work with some of the language? What are your wishes?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm glad to move that section, and I'm also very glad to look at the term cost-effective before we pass our final bill out. If there's concerns on the part of the conferees here, I would do that anyway, having heard the testimony. That's the first I've heard of that concern, and would gladly address it now before we get out of conference committee. But I would defer to the chair if you think that's not clean enough, but would commit to coming back with some kind of an amendment that would clear up that little section of language.
Well, I think we're in agreement with the exception of that, and being that you're willing to work on that, I think your motion would be appropriate.
So moved.
Representative Downey moves that we accept and adopt the House language. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lanning.
I appreciate Representative Downey's willingness to talk further with the department. And, of course, that means that he'll report back as to what the results of those conversations were. So we can come back to this again if we need to.
Any further discussion? Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, are we then, in according to this, on this deal here, are we moving just R36, that language, or are we moving all of it pertaining to state contracts?
Well, I believe the prudent thing to be would be to move it all.
Okay. Very good.
Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. We can move forward to page R36 and 37. Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, the next provision is from a bill carried by Representative Quam in the House. I believe Senator Senjum had the companion in the Senate. And this allows agencies to carry forward savings that are from one biennium to the next that are determined to be due to efficiencies. Subdivision 2 specifies that upon approval of the MMB commissioner, 50% of appropriations that are unspent because of unanticipated innovation, efficiencies, or creative cost savings can be carried forward. There's language that says that they would be fund-specific proposals or projects, and they would have to ensure that these project expenditures do not create future obligations, but rather would be used only to fund projects that directly support the agency's mission. There's a special peer review panel in Subdivision 3 and a requirement that MMB submit the request to the Legislative Advisory Commission for its review and recommendation. These monies would be put in a special account in the special revenue fund or another fund as determined by MMB, and the agency would manage and review projects funded from the account. There's one other technical provision on page R42 that is related. On the House side, it's section 34, line 35.3 to 35.8, and this is just a cross-reference that clarifies that money doesn't lapse if it's carried forward under the so-called savvy provision that I described earlier.
Any testimony on this part of the bill?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I understand that this is up for final consideration in the Senate.
And it did pass.
It did pass.
I neglected.
And is it identical, or are there some differences?
I don't believe that there was any amendments. I believe the wording was the same on Senjum's bill. Yes.
It's, Mr. Chairman, it has also it passed the House here, probably 6-8 weeks ago.
Correct. Mr. Shepherd, is there any
attachment to the R42 gain sharing with this?
Mr. Chair and members, the gain sharing came from a bill that it was an article of a bill that Representative Downey sponsored. I believe it was from House File 192, and so I think it's a related concept, but I don't think it was part of
okay.
this bill.
All right. Okay. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'll move this section. It was passed, I believe, unanimously in the Senate. It's a great encouragement for people to find ways to save money, for agencies to save money, and let them have some of it rather than going all. It's a great aid.
All right. Senator Gazelka moves to adopt the House language. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. R38, Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair, this House provision provides that the parking spaces on Aurora Avenue would be reserved for the public.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just think it's so important what we do here in the committee. I mean, I really feel like we're the watchdog for the taxpayers, and we got to look out for the little guy. And I just think that access to the government and the representatives and the senators is just really critical. And I think those parking spaces ought to be looked at, and we should just maybe have a discussion about that. But then I'm open to the other side of the argument here. So I don't know if any other comments.
Representative Stensrud, I understand there are numerous parking stalls in the House's lot. I mean, could we maybe even do that? I love that. Senator Vandeveer.
Mr. Chair, I just got back. I didn't make a candy run, but did anyone mention all the space in the ramp over there?
We were just discussing that a little bit. I'm somewhat, opposed to this because I'm not the type of senator that wants to feed the beast, and I think what we're ultimately going to end up doing here is taxing our citizens and feeding the beast of the general fund. And Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this idea came up one day when we saw all the snow on your cars. And we felt sorry for you that you had all that snow on your cars. And thought maybe there would be a better solution.
Well, I think, in all seriousness, I think we are dealing with a $260-plus million problem right here that we're sitting within. And I'm hoping that we see some activity happening with the CAP board and some of the planning. I'm hoping that we see some movement with legacy dollars because this is history. We are inside of history. And if there's any one thing I can say is that shame on the legislature for not coming together and finding a way to move money into repairing this building. But I think we're almost there. I think I'm seeing some great inroads being made and discussions, and the fact that parking will be one of those things that will be addressed as we move forward on that. So,
well, Mr. Chairman, this has been one of those annual sort of little needles that that the House has sent the Senate way. But in all seriousness, as we've talked about on the House side, we have a problem with public access to this building, and we have a lot of other related problems, the restoration of this Capitol, the being able to accommodate the needs of the House and the Senate and all the state government functions. And I'm going to continue to call for us as a legislature to develop a campus master plan here where we can address all of those problems and needs. So I guess I'm saying stay tuned. Next session you're going to hear something that we're going to be moving forward on in that regard. So we'll drop this for now.
All right. Sounds good.
Mr. Chair, if I can say,
Senator Gazelka.
Given the House all the rest of the language, so I'm glad we're not doing this.
All right. let's move on to R42, gain sharing.
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, the House provision there is from Representative Downey's House File 192. It's Section 35 at the bottom of the page. It requires the Commissioner of MMS to establish a program of one-time bonus compensation for state employees for efforts made to reduce the cost of operating state government or providing more efficient state services. There's a requirement for documented cost savings and a provision that the maximum award is 10% of the documented savings in the first fiscal year, and it would be paid from the appropriation to which the savings accrued.
Do we have any testimony on this part? Representative Downey, I might have a question.
Yeah.
I'm a little concerned that we don't have some kind of a dollar cap. What if I found $1.8 billion in savings? I mean, could it happen? Maybe, but wouldn't we want some kind of a cap there?
Mr. Chair, you raise an interesting point and one that I don't think I contemplated. We've been searching for every $500,000 and have been doing that for many years and have not found the $1.8 billion silver bullet. You know, I think the overall intention, if I could maybe speak to the previous section, the state contracts that we adopted, the gain sharing, Representative Stensrud's pay for performance bonds, and even this SAVI program that we just adopted. You know, we're just trying to align people's incentives to the work that we have in the executive branch and the legislative branch. In the private sector, I guess if you made the $1.8 billion deal or realized investments that granted you $1.8 billion, you'd realize the full success of that. I'd be curious whether or not a cap on this, if it were too low, would perhaps disincentivize folks. So anyway, I'm willing to listen to a discussion on it. I didn't contemplate caps when I first wrote the bill.
I just bring it up. I'm thinking, you know, will there be a day that we realize that our constitution here doesn't mandate us to provide health and human services, and that would fall into that? There's all of this discussion. I mean, if we ever get to the point, which I believe we're awful close, that we have to really look at what our constitution mandates us. And somebody says, well, here's a part of great savings. It could be substantial. And that's the only reason I brought that question up. So.
Mr. Chair, I think that's a great question. And it's not written this way, but my intention was that this would be things that do not require statutory enactment. And the things that I was thinking about in particular, some of which I've had a little bit of personal experience in myself, was people engage in very large projects and initiatives, work really hard, extra hours, putting in the new system, designing the new process, and at the end of that, there's a nice savings that accrues to the agency. And why shouldn't the people who did the work and discovered the ideas and made it happen share in that? Somebody participates in a Kaizen event and they're able to, you know, strip $100,000 out of some business process and the cost of that. Why shouldn't the commissioner be able to reward the people that were part of that project to continue to incentivize that kind of redesign? So if you thought that a cap would be appropriate, I'm glad to try and entertain a number or figure out a number in the meantime. But boy, I sure would like to have the same kind of incentives and alignment to performance and results that we have in so many other areas of work life to have that same opportunity for our state workers.
And Representative Downey, and it was a good question. The thing that And I myself like what you've done here. And the thing that helps with that is obviously it's discretionary. The commissioner, in your own language, the commissioner may make a one-time award. And I think that might help.
Mr. Chairman, I think that language probably covers it, too. I was just thinking in my head, I'll tell you what, if an employee showed up today with a $1.8 billion savings idea, I'd probably be pretty darn glad to pay him $180 million to get it.
And would this also, I'd like to have.
Mr. Shepherd is winking at me.
But
wheels are turning too. Yeah.
But as I understand this also, when you read through this discretionary may make a one-time, I think on line 3516, the fact that it says the maximum award is 10%, that also appears to me to say that that commissioner could say 2% or 6%. Am I reading that right, Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, maybe more realistically, they'd be talking about a $500 per person bonus award to the 10 people who did the Kaizen event who found $50,000 worth of savings or something. But we did want to have some kind of a cap.
All right. Senator Vanderveer.
Mr. Chair, I'm just wondering if we want to have the trial lawyers waiting on those.
Thank you, Senator Kozelka.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, are there any other states that are doing this? Or is this your idea, which I love? I'm just curious if any other states are doing it.
Representative Downey?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't know, honestly. We've talked about sharing savings programs a lot just in conversation. I couldn't tell you whether any public or private entity or public sector entities have implemented it.
I heard Representative Downey move to adopt the House language. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Let's go to pay for performance bonds, R43 through 47. Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, this entire block of language was from Representative Downey's House File 681, and if it's, Mr. Chair, if it's all right with you, perhaps Representative Downey would like to explain this provision.
Representative Downey?
I'm glad to, Mr. Chair, and then I'd be, after my brief introduction, I'd be glad to hear what the Senate's thoughts are. I think you had at least a hearing, or there has been some movement of Senator Rosen's bill. So the Pay for Performance Act is premised on the fact that we right now generally appropriate to outside organizations to deliver programs required in state law. And we, in this biennial budget process, come back and take a look and see what kind of success we've had and the kinds of results we've had. And the purpose of this program is to say, there are organizations that can demonstrate the return and the outcomes and the results that have been produced in these areas. And what we'd like to do is, instead of just directly appropriating all the time, we'd like to offer an opportunity for some outside private investment through the sale of appropriation bonds to be deployed to organizations that sign up for a pay-for-performance contract who only get paid at the point at which they can demonstrate the return to the state and can demonstrate that return in such a way that the return to the state can be booked, if you will, within the state financial systems to actually pay the debt service on the appropriation bonds. So the purpose is to provide an outside opportunity for people to fund these worthy programs, to leverage the power of the state and an appropriation bond in such a way that we get the kind of return on investment that we're looking for. And the reality is the state very clearly over time is not going to have the money to fund many of these programs. The nonprofit community is also struggling. In many ways, we're competing for the same dollars. So this is a mechanism that allows the state to help attract private investment to these worthy causes in a way that has a demonstrable return. So I can get into the details. I know I see Senator Rosen here. I see Mr. Rothschild, who actually envisioned the idea based on an organization that he runs called Twin Cities Rise, who has a pay-for-performance program like this already in our workforce budget, to provide additional testimony if they're interested. But maybe before that, Mr. Chair, I'd defer to you and the senators to just kind of get your thoughts and reactions and maybe where your mind is as a Senate position on this as well.
Well, I think Representative Downey, you know, we heard the bill, and I think there's great interest on behalf of the Senate. We just had some time constraints and ran out of some time to continue to move this forward. But I'm interested, and if anybody else is, to let Mr. Rothschild give some testimony, if he would. Welcome, and please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Steve Rothschild. I'm president of an organization called Invest in Outcomes. And as Representative Downey mentioned, chairman of Twin Cities Rise, both of which are nonprofits in the state of Minnesota.
I think, does anybody have any questions on the Senate side at all for Mr. Rothschild in reference to this section? Wow, this is pretty good, Representative Downey.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't want to go for the close too early, but I'd move adoption of my section if there's no. But I certainly want to have a full, well-rounded discussion tonight too, if we need to.
Any other testimony come forth? We do have a motion to adopt the House language, and we'll get to that. Please state your name.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Susie Brown. I'm with the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits, and I would like to encourage this committee to take the time, as you had suggested, Senator Perry. The Senate committee really raised several significant questions, over a dozen very important implementation questions, and it would be our recommendation that it would be worth the time to continue to work on this prior to passage. We're not opposed to the idea of looking at these very critical questions, and we appreciate Representative Downey and Senator Rosen's work with Mr. Rothschild to look at how we finance nonprofits and how we evaluate our outcomes. But should this kind of a proposal pass, it could represent a significant change in the relationship between nonprofits and government, and for that reason, we believe it's very much worth taking the time. A couple of issues that came up in the Senate committee prior to I think that was about a month ago when the Senate met, were that the Office of Management and Budget has significant implementation and management roles around the bonds and the financing. And they haven't been heard from, as far as I know, in any of these committees. And their input on how this would work would be essential. Additionally, there's an advisory committee that's set up through this that hasn't had sufficient detail discussed. The conversation in the Senate committee was that it hasn't had the NRES treatment. And so we would support taking the time to address some of the significant implementation issues before passage.
Any questions for our testifier? Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I didn't get your name again.
Susie Brown.
Ms. Brown. I'm sure you're aware that that this is a pilot program. And it would be my understanding that when you decide to test a pilot, that gives you an opportunity to really see if it works or doesn't. Do you have any thoughts about that? I mean, are you apprehensive about even a pilot that might test
Senate, Chairman, Representative Planning, committee members, we're grateful that it's a pilot. That's clearly the right place to start, but it seems to us that there are significant implementation questions that should be addressed even prior to the pilot being implemented.
Representative Lane?
No.
Okay. Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Brown, you mentioned that your concerns that the Office of Management and Budget didn't weigh in on this issue or the an advisory committee. Were they at the committee hearing a month ago when the presentation was made on this issue of the pilot program or performance act?
Ms. Brown.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, I don't know if they were in the room. They weren't called on to provide their testimony. It was raised by one of the members of the committee that they were interested in management and budget's point of view on this.
Representative Mr. Anderson.
Chair. Well, I'd like to, Ms. Brown mentioned some questions that were brought up by your side and in committee, and I'd just like to know what, if there were questions that can be asked again tonight. Or this afternoon here, that we could at least hear the concerns, other than the fact that we should study it. I'd like to hear what your concerns or the Senate's concerns were asked at that time, if anybody has that information.
I'm being reminded of a couple of things that, and I think one of the questions was on how the financing would work on this, and I don't know if Mr. Rothschild, you could articulate that, or Representative Downey, would you like to?
Mr. Chairman, just a brief introduction to some of the questions, and then I think it would be helpful to hear from Mr. Rothschild on some of the details. As Chair Lanning mentioned, this is a pilot. And for those who may have taken the time to really read the provisions, there are a lot of very tight controls in this language. First and foremost, the Oversight Committee must include the commissioners of the Departments of Human Services, DEED, and admin, as well as other representatives. And maybe most importantly, those who would choose to do so or have the language can look at the language on R45, lines 37.22 to 37.34. And most importantly, in there, in addition to kind of the process controls that and the constraints that are imposed on the commissioner before even issuing the bonds or selling the bonds, there must be performance contracts in place that give the commissioner confidence that they can sell and issue those bonds only in an amount that the commissioner determines will result in principal and interest payments more than the amount of the bond. So I think there's pretty tight controls on this. It's entirely possible that as you get into this and build the performance metrics and things, I mean, you can envision a scenario where the pilot, if you will, fails before even issuing the bonds. I think there's enough confidence in the return on investment metrics that we have for many of these organizations that probably wouldn't happen. But I just want people to realize we're not just running out and selling bonds. There's a lot of tight controls. The administration is bound by its processes for selling bonds. And I know a lot of consultation has gone on with bond counsel, both in the private sector and here in the administration, and we can hear from Mr. Rothschild on that. And I do know we have even discussed a little bit of amendment language that might come forward if some suggestions from, I think it's admin, might prevail to make sure we don't have any kind of constitutional issues with this as well. So they have worked pretty extensively with the administration, and we can hear more from Mr. Rothschild on that.
Thank you, Representative Downey. Mr. Rothschild.
Mr. Chairman, members, this idea has been vetted by over 100 organizations and individuals that represent a wide array of interest groups in the state, including the Citizens League, the United Way, at least 30 nonprofit organizations which have endorsed it, members, many of whom are members of the Minnesota Council of Foundations, by the way, and former state commissioners, legal counsel outside, bond counsel. And so the feeling of the group that is proposing this and came forward to suggest it is that this has been vetted sufficiently to test it. And it's our belief that you could continue to study this forever but you would never learn very much by continuing to have working groups, and that what we ought to be doing is testing it to see what works, because you can't anticipate every unintended consequence. And the only way to do that in a world that is dynamic is to try something. And then if it's a little off, you make adjustments. But you can't learn enough by continuing to study something forever. That's the reason that we're proposing, as Representative Lanning said, a pilot. We want to try it. And I think the people that have endorsed this believe that as well.
Thank you. Any further testimony from Ms. Brown? Anything? Thank you, and I appreciate your concerns. Any questions of Mr. Rothschild? Thank you, Mr. Rothschild. Any further testimony on this part of the bill? Welcome, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, for the record.
Commissioner, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you if you were here to negotiate or you were just presenting information.
Mr. Chair, I'm pleased to see we still have a sense of humor. I'm here to testify in this particular provision and to give you some understanding, or at least some of my perspectives, since this is an authority that would be expected of the Commissioner of Management and Budget.
Please.
We have some significant concerns. We respect the work that Mr. Rothschild and others have done to try and look at ways to finance this activity. Particularly the performance evaluation process is something I think we can all say is something that is a useful element. But at its core, we hoped that there would be some way to work this through, but at its core, using bond appropriations or bond proceeds for a programmatic aspect, a non-capital activity, is not something we really want to experiment with. The state has had a long-standing practice of using general obligation bonds, using those for capital assets. Very, very seldom has it used appropriation bonds. And so if we wanted to pursue this type of programmatic model, and we could continue the way we're already doing it, which is direct appropriations, that takes out a lot of costs. It takes out a lot of costs from the financing mechanism. It takes out a lot of cost from the consultants and everyone else. It really gets you to the program and the performance evaluation element of it. So that, at the core, is the concern. It's been a longstanding debt policy. Kristen Hansen, Assistant Commissioner for Debt Management, is on her way here. If you want to talk more about the specific mechanics, I can certainly talk about some of those. But the primary issue is really whether the debt feature here adds anything to the proposed activity.
Commissioner, you make the statement that you don't want to experiment with this. Can you expound upon that a little bit more?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I just heard a comment just a minute ago talking about trying to learn and experiment as a pilot. I understand that approach. But this is not an incremental kind of thing where you're opening a door for appropriation bonds for this activity. It's not an incremental change. I think if the legislature wants to start using debt for a broader array of things, it will be entertaining a lot of different proposals, much broader, less articulated than this one. And I think that's a policy issue that I think, as your financial advisors, we would not want to be pursuing.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, I think if I could, I'd like to invite Mr. Rothschild back up, because I'm sure he has some thoughts there, too. And some of this has to do, I think, with the risk, and maybe Mr. Rothschild can address that, too. I think what's missing a little bit when we talk about the risk or the cost, the added cost of this mechanism. And I think people need to realize or ask ourselves the question, what is the cost of just pushing money out the door as we have done for decades and not really having, I'll say, an accountability or some ability to measure whether or not those programs are actually doing what we thought they would or what was expounded on in the press conferences of the legislature after we passed these programs. And I think there's a real accountability issue in this kind of, in this program area that Mr. Rothschild is proposing that we focus on. And so, you know, what is the cost of $20 million that goes out the door that produces nothing as compared to putting some capital out there and requiring that every dollar we spend has been proven to have produced the outcome that we wanted? And so I think the cost discussion needs to be considered in its entirety, not just in the microscopic sense that, gee, there's an incremental cost to the debt and the process we've laid out. But I'll let Mr. Rothschild explain a little further maybe his perspective.
Mr. Rothschild.
Mr. Chairman, members, the intention of this bond is to test a new financing mechanism for the highest performing nonprofits and other social providers in the state. And as Representative Downey indicated, those nonprofits are already experiencing cuts and will continue to experience cuts as a result of the demographic changes in the state over the next 25 years. And so we're faced with nonprofits are faced with a kind of a death by a thousand cuts scenario, and we're looking for new revenue that makes sense for the state in an economic sense. This bond is not intended to replace appropriations, and so it's not a matter of borrowing money when you have appropriations available to spend. It's to provide funding where there aren't appropriations, or to supplement appropriations where high performers can earn enough to pay off the bond itself, plus the administrative costs, which have been figured in. And we know through analysis that's been done by the economists at the Wilder Foundation that there are a number of nonprofits in the state that meet that criteria already, and for which this would provide incremental investment opportunity to work with more needy people at no cost to the state of Minnesota, no cost to the general fund, because the savings that are generated by the intervention on the part of these organizations create sufficient cost avoidance in the state budget to pay off the bond, pay back the principal, and perhaps provide positive arbitrage or something extra for the state. And so we're faced with the reality that our organizations are getting cut and having to cut back, and we're facing that well into the future, well beyond this biennium, and we don't see any solution. The federal government isn't going to bail us out. The nonprofit community doesn't have any more. In order to make up the difference, we'd need four new United Ways started every year. That's just not going to happen. So what we need to do is find and experiment with new sources of revenue that also create the kind of economic value to the state that ensures that the money is spent appropriately. And that's what this intends to do. It's not intended to add another burden. It's intended to pay for itself and do good public policy at the same time.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, maybe just I won't say a final comment if there's more discussion and questions and testimony, but we've talked a lot about reform and new ideas and innovation, and I'll say kind of going back to my business mindset, you know, there's improvement and process improvement, and then there's reforms, which are more structural and organizational in nature, and then there's innovation where you try to break new ground and do new things, and then there's transformation where you really try and look at things through a new lens. And I can say, I think this might be one of, if not the only major transformational idea in terms of the way we look at the way we're funding social services and programs in the state. And this is a pilot. It's an extremely carefully controlled pilot with, I think, extremely low risk to the state in its totality. It's something that Mr. Rothschild has I think attracted a lot of national and even international attention to, and that we would be, I think, wise and actually good stewards of this whole kind of state of Minnesota legacy that we've got to think about doing this, at least in this controlled pilot way, to test this. And if it works, I think we've got something that can really apply itself in a lot of unique ways, and we can be way ahead in terms of the way we deliver these social service programs. So I'd argue for us to, in spite of the fact that, you know, it hasn't been studied by, you know, 15 academies with, you know, inch-thick reports summarizing it, I think we've got a great, well-tuned proposal here from Mr. Rothschild, and I'd urge member support.
Any further? Commissioner?
May I just make one comment, but I also don't want to belabor the point, but I think the financing mechanism has no necessary relationship to the social benefit of the program. I think Mr. Rothschild and plenty of other programs provide social benefit. That is still a separate issue than how you finance it. And I think that's sort of the core of the issue that I'm bringing to the committee.
Thank you. Representative Stensford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I'm also a member on the Jobs and Economic Development Committee, where we've looked at organizations like Twin Cities Rise and, dozens of different groups, all who make a compelling anecdotal story. And they bring people who have been benefited. You know, they'll bring a person and say, this person was in need, and now they're a productive citizen. But you cannot quantify that. So sitting in that, we spend millions and millions in our state, all with promises that, oh, this saves, you know, every dollar you spend saves four. Every dollar you spend, I mean, the true quotes, they say, we save $4, $8 for every dollar you spend. One group says, we save $16 for every dollar you spend. If that was true in every situation, we could just give them all $1 billion and our budget problem would be solved. I would welcome an opportunity to see justified and provable results with some of these nonprofits, and then you can pick winners and losers. I mean, either they justify themselves and can show a savings. I think it's worth sticking our neck out and trying a pilot and see what kind of results we would get. It could transform how we do a lot of these social services.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Any further testimony on this? I was just thinking in my head, Representative Stensrud, what a unique idea, ROI, return on investment. Anything else from the committee? We do have a motion from Representative Downey to accept the House language in this section. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Let's move on to R-47, E-Verify. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, the section on E-Verify is on page R-47, section 40 on the House side, line 40.6 and 40.10. This was Representative Leidiger's bill in the House. It provides that these the contracts referred to here are state contracts for services valued in excess of $50,000, and it would require certification from the vendor and any subcontractors that they have implemented or are in the process of implementing the E-Verify program for their newly hired employees.
All right. Testimony. Please state your name.
I'm Ernie Leidiger, representative from Carver County.
Do you have testimony you'd like to provide?
Yes, I do. Thank you for inviting me to speak this evening in this small room with all these people in 80 degree weather. Thank you very much.
Yes.
I want to talk to about E-Verify. First, just briefly describe it, what it is. It's a voluntary online system that allows employers to quickly check the work authorization status of their new hirees. The Department of Homeland Security and the Social Security Administration partnered to operate E-Verify, and it's overseen by the United States Citizen and Immigration Service. E-Verify works by allowing employers to electronically compare information taken from the I-9 form, against millions of records that in the SSA's database and records in the Department of Homeland Security's immigration databases. A little history on E-Verify. This was passed by the House in 2008, was not passed by the Senate. It was turned to an executive order by Governor Pawlenty. We have been operating the very same way that the bill talks about, which is companies over 50,000 doing contract worth over $50,000 with the state must use this system. Then Governor Dayton a few weeks ago decided not to continue the policy. To get to the, I mean, this is a great system. It is used by 14 states around the country. It is the one system that we have that screens employees to see if they're eligible to work and provides for instantaneous feedback. In fact, some of the figures are that 98.3% of employees are automatically confirmed as authorized to work either instantaneously or within 24 hours, requiring no employee or employer action. And of the 1.7% of employees receiving initial system mismatches, only 0.3% are later confirmed to be work authorized, and 1.43% are not work authorized. Now, if want to talk figures, and we think that there may be 10 million people that are here in the United States illegally over the 200 million workers that we have. We're talking about 5% of the people here are here illegally. This system has screened out almost 25% of that population. We've seen great improvement in the system, and I believe that we should continue using it. There is a fiscal note on it. It doesn't cost any additional dollars because this is something we've been doing for several years. I believe that we should continue doing it. Now, there's two objections or concerns. One has been with the accuracy of the system, and as I stated, it has improved by many percentage points in the last few years. And the federal government intends to invest another $135 million into the system, at least they have in 2012. And the other objection has been that it's been a duplication of effort, and the fact of the matter is there is no other system that's like this that can give you an instantaneous response whether somebody's legal to be able to work here. And lastly, in all the research that people have done about E-Verify, the one thing that nobody seems to mention is the vast amounts of energy and dollars that have been saved by companies out there by using that system and knowing right away in the hiring process whether a person is eligible to work or not. Through the I-9 system, it may take many, many months before someone is caught. So a company saves an enormous amount of money in savings in their training of those people. They don't know that a person may have fraudulent papers, for instance, and they have that person on board, they may invest an enormous amount of time and energy and dollars to bring that person up to speed just to have the person perhaps leave later on down the line because of their ineligibility to work. This saves companies money. It is a bill that Minnesota workers support. This is a bill all about protecting these jobs for Minnesota workers who are legal to work. And it denies jobs to those people who are here illegally and are not eligible to work. I'll stand for any questions, sir.
Any questions? Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, a couple questions. Is there a cost to employers to use the system?
Representative?
There are estimates that have been touted around, but it is a very simple system. It's all online. It's putting the Social Security number, name, and address in the system. There are companies that are out there that you can hire to do this for you. The companies that I've talked to that use construction companies predominantly, they use it. They like it. It's simple. Doesn't cost them. Essentially, it's all built into a company's HR department, and the adoption rate is something like 1,500 companies per month across the nation. So, sure,
Senator Gazelka.
If they find an undocumented worker, what happens when they find an undocumented worker?
Representative,
they report.
No, there's no requirement to report it. I mean, it's in the system. So certainly somebody knows that they're not eligible to work, and the company cannot hire that person. There's no additional reporting or anything else that is required by that company. And Mr. Chairman, I do have an amendment to this bill that I'm not sure whether it has been addressed yet or not. And that would be the exemption of the State Board of Investment. The State Board of Investment deals with contracts with companies that have a much higher standard of scrutiny. Security and Exchange Commission and those kinds of things. So when I introduced this in committee, it was unanimously supported to exempt that one agency. So I'd like to move that be approved.
Yeah, there has to be.
I would move that we adopt the amendment.
Representative Benson moves the A41 amendment. Any discussion on the amendment? All those in favor of the A41 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Any further testimony on this part of the bill that we're looking at? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Leidiger, you said that the federal government's planning to invest $135 million in the use of this program. I'm wondering if you can give some examples of where it's being used there with the federal government.
Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a blurb that we received from testimony in Congress, and then I have hearsay.
We're not interested in the hearsay.
Okay. The Obama administration supports E-Verify as a fair and efficient way to document the legal status of employees and to help employers fulfill their legal obligations to hiring workers who are legally able to work in the United States. In his fiscal year 2012 budget request, he asked for $132 million for E-Verify. And I won't mention the hearsay about.
All right. Any further questions? Wishes of the committee? Is there any further testimony?
I move that we adopt the language.
Representative Benson moves that we adopt the House language. Any further comments? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails, carries. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members.
So move on to Legislative Auditor on page R50. Mr. Shipp.
Mr. Chair and members, the House provision on R50, my summary of this misidentifies it. The summary says it relates to county fairs. That's not correct. It relates to the state fair. It may be audited by the legislative auditor or a private auditor. And the language is on the top of page R51 that has the change. And see, Mr. Nobles is here if the Congress had questions about this.
Mr. Can we kind of put also R65 through 66? As long as we have Mr. Nobles here, can we address both of them? Mr. Shepherd?
Mr. Chair, on R65 and 66 is another provision related to the legislative auditor. The substantive language is on the top of R66 on 50.3 to 50.9, and this allows the legislative auditor to carry forward, to use money carried forward for audits related to MNSKU. And Mr. Nobles can explain that one further as well, I'm sure.
Mr. Nobles, has anyone told you you do a good job?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're
you just did. Thank you.
Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for allowing us to combine those because they are actually connected. We have a lot of organizations that we have jurisdiction to audit, and we have limited resources, and so we're always looking for ways that we can use those resources in a strategic way by a risk assessment of where they ought to be deployed. And as we do that every year, we come upon a mandate that we have to go over to the state fair and do an annual audit of their financial statements. Frankly, it's a fun audit. A lot of my staff sign up for it because you get to kind of see behind the scenes of the state fair. But for me, I would rather deploy those resources on other things, specifically on the new responsibility that we have to audit the four legacy funds. And so I ask that you relieve the Office of the Legislative Auditor of the requirement that we audit the financial statements of the state fair on an annual basis. I think that's work that can be done quite adequately by a CPA firm. And so we would reluctantly, I guess, because again, it's a fun audit, but it's work that can be done by the CPA firms. And frankly, that's a model that we follow for a number of other organizations that we have jurisdiction. We have jurisdiction to audit the Mosquito Control Commission, for example, and the Historical Society. But we defer and allow those organizations to use a CPA firm to annually audit their financial statements. We retain the jurisdiction to follow up on any issues that might arise. So that's the first provision, Mr. Chairman. The second provision on carry forward is connected because when we received responsibility to audit the four legacy funds, we did not receive any additional money to do that. And I'm not asking you for additional money. I'm asking you simply that we be allowed, as Mr. Shepherd said, to use the carry forward money that we already have authority to use for limited purposes, and this would simply expand it to allow us to use that money to audit legacy funds and MNSKU campuses. So, Mr. Chairman, that's the essence, the substance of the two provisions that I have before you.
Any question for Mr. Knowles? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, in recommending a private CPA, is there someone that does that require an RFP or anything like that for them to bid on this or to do that work for private or for your situations that you just mentioned?
Mr. Nobles.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Anderson, that would, of course, be the choice of the state fair, or as it's actually called, the State Agricultural Society that operates the state fair. They are not strictly a state agency. They're a quasi-state agency created by the state and have some obligations under state law. But I'm sure that knowing the state fair as a well-run organization, they would undoubtedly put out an RFP and take bids among various CPA firms that would be qualified to do that work. So I think, although it is at their discretion, I think that's the route they would follow.
Thank you.
Who Mr. Nobles, I'm trying to. So what this language is doing is giving the state fair the authority to pick between a private auditor or the legislative auditor? I'm trying
well,
to
Mr.
understand
Chairman,
it
would right now they have an obligation to have an audit done by us, and so it would simply give them an option, and it would be our choice that they choose a CPA firm to do their financial statement audit work.
What are you going to do with the extra time?
Mr. Chairman, we're going to dedicate that to the legacy funds that we have a responsibility to audit. In fact, we are currently doing that work now. As you know, so far there's been approximately $200 million allocated from the legacy funds, and it's our responsibility to audit those, and that's what we're doing. That's what we will be doing with those hours.
You were so serious there. I was just kind of throwing a little levity. I thought maybe.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I thought maybe you were going to say you were going to take a break, head
no,
to Florida for a couple of days, or.
Mr. Chairman, I thought I had brought something to you that was pretty easy and non-controversial. So.
Well, we haven't called on Senator Daley on this one yet. we're going to work on his reaction to.
I think I know Senator Daley's reaction from another bill that he sponsors.
Well, let's see what Senator Daley has to say. Senator Daley, do you have comments on this section?
Mr. Chair, maybe we could get the OLA and the OSA together, and we could share some of those ideas and get the state auditor and legislative auditor to coordinate their efforts. It's a pretty good idea. Yeah.
Any further questions of Mr. Nobles here? Do we have any other testimony? Representative Anderson.
Well, Mr. Chair, I see that this bill was referred to State Government Innovation and Veterans Affairs. Senator Rest had heard the bill. I don't know if it was heard over in the Senate or not.
I don't believe we had a chance to hear this bill.
Okay.
Representative
Mr. Chairman,
Lyon?
I would add, though, that it was heard in the House and before Representative Lanning's committee.
Representative Lennon.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We did hear it. We did pass the language. It is in our state government finance omnibus bill. And so I would move the House language on the state fair audit.
Representative Lanning moves the House language on the state fair audit. And I would just make one comment that surely appears to follow some of the bills and the ideas that we've been moving forward in the Senate. So any further discussion on this? Mr. Noble.
Mr. Chairman, I believe you will also want to move the other language.
We'll do that next. Any further discussion? All those in favor of adopting the House language on the this particular audit and section, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. And now we go back to R6566, the carry forward authority. Any further discussion on that? That's on page R66, House language 50.3 through 50.9.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that the House language on that issue as well.
Representative Lanning moves the House language on that. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Noble. Let's move forward to performance appraisals on R53. Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and members, this the commissioner referred to here on the bottom of R53 and section 46 is the Commissioner of Management and Budget and the performance appraisal system for executive branch state employees. This is from a bill by Representative Stensrud, House File 756, and it requires that the performance appraisal system have three components: evaluation of individual agencies, individual employees' performance, performance of the individual employees' program, and performance of the agency toward meeting targeted outcomes for the agency. It then provides on page R54. That pay increases for all employees would be based on the evaluations with the factors specified above and any other factors that are negotiated in collective bargaining agreements. It then provides that employees in the executive branch may not receive a salary increase based on cost of living or progression unless the supervisor certifies that the employee's performance has been satisfactory. The section contains a paragraph providing that this section does not apply to the faculty administrators in the state colleges and university system.
Thank you. Any testifiers to this part of the bill? Representative Stenser, do you have anything you'd like to say?
Well, I just think that, Mr. Chair, it just really helps create an environment. I mean, a lot of the bills that we've been proposing and are including in here really try and change the attitude and maybe the work environment for those of us in state government. And performance-based pay, you know, how are we doing rewarding the performers? And you talk about, you know, rewarding those with confined savings and compensating them. And it just sort of goes along with creating a culture in which, you know, we're going to reward those who perform really well and look at our goals personally and how are we fitting in with, you know, the departments. I just think that I've never worked for a business or an organization where you weren't evaluated on these criteria. Oftentimes, you know, if the company does well, the employees can do well if they're performing well at their role. And I think it just makes sense, and it just creates a good culture where we're looking at our departments. We want everyone to do well, and I just think it fits in with kind of a theme of where we're going with this whole omnibus bill. We have to answer any questions.
Any questions for Representative Stensrud on this? I would have one. Why are we excluding Minsky? Representative Benson?
They already have a system that allows for the faculty to be rewarded in this way. That's why they were excluded.
Is it working?
Mr. Chairman, I would say it must be. This was a recommendation of Representative Banyan, who is a professor at St. Cloud. And he was the person that offered that recommendation.
Good. Any further questions? Senator Vandiver?
So, Mr. Chair, one person who's an instructor at MSQ said it's okay and we dropped it.
He was a representative.
Representative Benson?
Representative Banyan. And he helped provide that testimony. There was other testimony from the college system also.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Downey?
Well, to that question, it's a very good one, and I'm sure we could have some discussion about whether if it's already being done, whether including them in the requirement is unnecessarily redundant or entirely appropriate. We could have that discussion. But just a little bit of context, I happen to have a good friend who's on the Minsky board, and for about 4 or 5 years, I think Minsky is to be commended. They actually have a performance dashboard for their organization as a whole and for every one of their institutions that you can go out to the website and view. And they have aligned college president's compensation to that dashboard. They've got a fairly significant performance-based bonus program, and I know that drives all the way down into the organization. So I think the point is maybe worth discussing whether or not we you need to exclude them if they're already doing it or not. But anyway, I think there's more than just one person's testimony, Senator, that I think substantiated the basis for it.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Vandiver.
On the theory that there's nothing that's working, we can't break. I will let it go from here to my turn.
Are you moving the House language, Senator Vandiver?
No, Mr. Chair, they can do that.
I think I heard Representative Stenshrud move the House language.
I would move that we adopt this language.
Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same side. Motion prevails. What one was that? Okay, so we're on R54 through 55, CGIP, HSA. Mr. Bodder?
So, Mr. Chairman, beginning on R54 with the substantive languages, language shown on the bottom of R55, this is a Senate-only provision that changes the state employee group insurance plan and basically has three components to it that you can see called out in the different clauses. Beginning in item one with the state depositing specified amounts in the individual health savings accounts, $1,500 for an individual, $2,500 for an employee with a family health savings account. And then in clause two, providing the terms of the high deductible health care plan that would be provided or made available to those employees. For individuals, that's a $2,500 deductible, and for families, a $5,000 initial deductible. And then the maximum out-of-pocket amounts are specified. And finally, in clause three, the state's contribution to the monthly premium payment is specified there, $140 for individuals, $411 for family coverage.
Thank you, Mr. Bonner. Committee members, I want to hear if Mr. Morocco could come forward. I'd like to hear some testimony from him. It's not my intent that we move on this because of the dollars that are attached to it. My intent is to give us all an opportune moment here to discuss with Mr. Morocco and amongst ourselves some of the thoughts that we might have on this. Welcome, Mr. Morocco, and maybe you could give us some testimony on your thoughts on this.
Sure. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Nathan Morocco. I'm the director of the Employee Insurance Division, and I oversee the State Employee Group Insurance Program. Mr. Chair, is there anything specific? I can certainly address specific aspects, or if you'd like to, I did prepare just sort of a one-pager on questions that have come into me that I thought could be of value, if you want to sort of step through that, if you want some assessment of how the plan, the proposed plan might compare to the existing plan, if you think that's of value. Otherwise, I'm well, happy to answer any questions.
I think the big issue right out of the chute is how did the savings come back to the state? I mean, maybe you could explain that point, we can go from there.
Mr. Chair and members of the committees, essentially what the plan design is doing is it's really fixing the state's liability through a fixed dollar amount on the premium. The employees pay a significant larger portion than they currently do today, somewhere in the range of about $2,000 to $6,000 per employee, depending on if you have single or family coverage. So those are expenses that they're not currently incurring. That they would, and that then alleviates some of the responsibilities from the state. That's really kind of the first component. The second component then is on the plan design. With a high deductible health plan, I believe it's $2,500 is the upfront deductible. That's an expense that many more members will incur out of their pocket that would have been placed to the plan's responsibility under the existing plan. So that's, as an example, about roughly 4% of our members pay about $1,100 in medical expenses today. Under this proposed plan, about 50% of the members would incur that same level of expense, that $1,100. So the cost of the whole program essentially stays the same. It's really who's paying for the program, and it's both on the premium and the plan design side is more of it's being picked up by the employees, and that translates into a cost savings for the state.
Representative Benson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you give us an approximate number of single policies and family policies?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there's about 50,000 state employees 40% of them have single coverage, 60% of them have family coverage. And just as a reminder, members of the committee, 50,000 may sound like a lot. That's because the CGIP program has all three branches of government. It has the Minsky system. It also has many quasi-state agencies like the Historical Society, State Fair Boards, things like that. So it is a larger entity than the executive branch of government.
Mr. Morocco, can you explain the HSA portion? That does a lot to the premium cost. Doesn't it lower it? Or can you explain a little bit of that to the committee?
Sure, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. So the HSA contribution is currently set at $1,500 for singles and $2,500 for family. The HSA contribution is not eligible towards the payment of the premium by law. So whatever expenses are incurred by the member, again, that's in the range between little over $2,000 for single and $6,000 for family, they're not able to offset that premium with the HSA. However, they are able to use that HSA contribution on the plan design side. So when you have $3,500 out-of-pocket maximums for single and $6,500, if I've got that number right, on family, they're able to offset that with either a $1,500 or $2,500 contribution. So, Mr. Chair, I wouldn't say that there's necessarily a correlation between the HSA contribution and the premium. I would say that the HSA helps to offset some of the costs to the employees. Certainly, there are employers out there who implement high-deductible health plans and provide nothing in terms of an HSA contribution. There's nothing that says that you have to contribute anything if you don't want to. So if you want to manage your liability or cost sharing with members, you could, if you want the state to pay less, put less into the HSA. If you want the state to contribute more, you could certainly contribute more to the HSA. And to the extent that members experience more out-of-pocket expenses, you would be helping to offset those costs.
All right. Senator Gazelka and then Representative Downing. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, what is the minimum deductible that you can have to qualify as an HSA policy?
Mr. Morocco.
That you have HSA.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, I'm not an insurance expert, but my assumption is it's around $2,000. But there may even be members on the committee that are. Okay.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, I don't totally know how to absorb all of this in terms of the per cost to the individual employee, but there's about $144 million of savings through this provision. And I'm curious, do you just have a rough idea of how much of that is quote-unquote borne by the employees as compared to how much is a result of moving to the higher deductible plans and some of these other plan components?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, if I understand the question right, are you asking are there broader savings by moving to a high deductible health plan aside from the cost sharing differences, or?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, I guess my assumption is that there is a savings in just the overall plan costs to the state. And I'm curious how much of this $144 million is coming because we've redesigned the plans as compared to requiring the employee matches and the higher deductibles and things.
Okay. Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, if I'm not answering your question, certainly let me know. If I understand where you're going, certainly there is some discussion about what is the value of a high deductible health plan. There certainly are different schools of thoughts on this, so I'll just simply represent sort of where we come and where some of our actuaries come at this. In essence, there isn't really a value in moving to a high-deductible health plan. And the reason being this, that the state in 2002 implemented the Advantage health plan that you all experience. That program is directing, through the tiered networks, directs about 85% of state employees to cost level 1 and 2 clinics. What that means is that through that plan design, most of our members are already going to the most efficient care systems in the state. If you compare that to, let's say, a typical employer who has long left sort of the gatekeeper model that we have and have said, well, we want to allow our members to go wherever they want. We want, you know, sort of freedom of choice. And in that kind of open access environment where members are not are under traditional plan, they're very much shielded from the cost and the transparency around the cost of care by provider. So when you go from that environment and then you expose them to the cost with an upfront deductible, now they realize when they have $2,500 at stake, now they are going to start to shop around for more efficient care. So they both certainly are, I think, are valid attempts at creating the transparency necessary to achieve these savings. You can't necessarily stack them on top of each other because they largely accomplish the same thing. Now, when we've had discussions around this, because certainly there are different schools of thought, you know, we have spoken with our actuaries, Deloitte Consulting. We've also spoken with the consultants at Blue Cross, Health Partners, and Preferred One. And while there's some minor range in terms of how much credit they're willing to give to the high-deductible health plan, it's pretty minimal, anywhere between zero and maybe a couple percentage points. Nothing. So really, the bulk of this savings really is just coming from the plan design change, which is it really asking the members to pay more for the cost of the benefits. Is that the question you were asking, or did I?
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, that is the question that I was asking, and your answer seems counterintuitive, but I'll let it go, and we can explore offline if I need to. Thank you.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I've at least seen in the past that when people move to higher deductibles, there's, they think a lot before they decide that they're going to just get care versus a very low deductible or no deductible on some of the health care the government provides to people that's just used over you. And so I would think there would be some savings there with the realization that your only choice is a high deductible plan. To not have overuse.
Mr.
You're saying that that's not
the
fact.
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Senator Gazelka, I think you raise an excellent point, but I think there are a lot of other components to the program that help to manage that. We really are a primary care-based type of program. If you're in the healthcare arena and you hear things about medical homes, accountable care organizations, that really is the fundamental premise of the program. So. We're really managing utilization by asking the clinicians themselves to manage the health care of these folks. So they're not running off to the specialty group. They're coming to the primary doctor and saying, I've got a condition. And it's that primary doctor who is held accountable for the total cost of care is saying, there's better ways that we can treat this condition. Or, generic drugs might be better than a name brand. Or perhaps we don't want to go to surgery for lower back. Perhaps we want to do physical therapy. It's for that very reason that those clinics are high-performing clinics, is because they do manage the health. So it very well may be the case that members are going to rush to our cost level 1 and 2, but it's for the very nature that they're held accountable for the total cost of care that they're going to say, well, we think there, you know, we understand you're looking for some medical services, but we think we have the best way to provide it, and they prove that through lower costs.
Mr. Morocco, as you look at this, my understanding also is that there are some benefits on this that currently aren't there. Preventative care is under this particular bill would be picked up. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. Similar to the current Advantage plan, and is a common theme really now in healthcare, is that preventative care is very cost-effective care. And so it's covered at 100% under both the proposed plan and the existing plan.
And on the HSA side, that is carried over and can be built upon year after year if that is not used. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that is absolutely correct.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Morocco, as I understand, you are kind of our lead negotiators in the collective bargaining process as it relates to health insurance. Is that correct?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, that is correct.
And thinking about that process of trying to negotiate agreements on this, could you comment on the differences between our designing a plan that you have to implement versus our setting some kind of a goal as to what we're trying to achieve by way of savings, and then trying to do that through the collective bargaining process?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, you know, certainly the collective bargaining process is the place that we talk about the plan design, mm-hmm. and if we have a broader goal in mind, say it be a specific maybe savings or what have you, you know, certainly from a management perspective, we would prefer to have as much flexibility as we can. There are many components in the proposed high deductible health plan that already exist in the current Advantage health plan. So as an example, the high deductible health plan has a $2,500 first dollar deductible. We also have a first dollar deductible. It just happens to be lower. It's $140 for singles. The proposed plan has an out-of-pocket maximum. At singles, it's $3,500. In the current plan, we also have an out-of-pocket maximum. It's $1,900 for medical and pharmacy. So we have a lot of the same similar types of provisions. And so how we go about creating the savings, again, from a flexibility perspective, the more options that we have, the better. Certainly a high deductible health plan can be a very viable solution to achieving some of these savings. But there may be other alternatives or options that will not be available because, you know, the language is as prescriptive as it is. It requires that it be a high deductible health plan that is HSA compliant. And again, I'm not saying that is not a viable option, but that requires it to be the only option.
Okay. Representative Lang.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The language that we're considering, that we're not adopting here tonight, but we're considering, is it your view that significantly restricts your ability to come up with different ways of achieving the same goal of trying to save some money here on health insurance?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lanning, it certainly does restrict the options that we have. There are many kinds of products out there in the marketplace. This is one of them, and it would be the only one that would be available to us.
Thank you.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of follow-on questions to Representative Lanning's line of questioning. Mr. Morocco, are we self-funded?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, yes, we are self-funded.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Downey.
Took that as a compliment. Thank you. Mr. Morocco, so when you talk about other options, would be moving to a kind of an off-the-shelf set of options and choices be something that you would consider, or are you in this range of other options thinking that you'd still stay in the self-funded world?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, my presumption is we would stay in the self-insured world just because it's it's a cheaper way to go in a group our size. We can underwrite our own risk, but I think we can, if there was something in the fully insured market that we thought would save money, I think we're large enough that we can probably recreate that kind of environment. I guess I haven't seen anything so complicated, and frankly the tiered product is a fairly complex structure. I think we could recreate it, but
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Morocco. I remember your presentation to our committee, and thank you for breaking down what is one of the most complicated things in the world, this whole health insurance funding world. And I remember looking and realizing that it was our reserves that produced and there's some kind of natural cycle to that, and that was what really produced some of our great financial results in the cost of our health care the last few years. And if we gave you this flexibility, is there any chance that that might create an incentive, unintended incentive, to try and manage things less from a plan design and sharing the cost with employees and more towards just managing your broader financial environment? Or are you so tightly controlled that you wouldn't be tempted to go find half of our savings just because we're managing reserves or some other macroeconomic funding mechanisms that you would have control over? Would there be a temptation of that or no?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, I'm not sure if I understand the limitations that we might have, as you're indicating. You know, to the point of reserves, and as it relates to your fully insured question, that's precisely why we would prefer to be self-insured. If we were to implement a program, and that program should be massively successful, under a fully insured environment, we would not reap any of those benefits, and that's precisely why we want to be self-insured. So if there are savings, we keep those savings and we use that to moderate future premiums. But I don't think I'm answering the other part of your question, but I'm not sure that I.
Representative Downing.
That's right, Mr. Chair. I mean, we're going to have some time to
sure.
continue to process this. And then last question. So you mentioned, Mr. Chair, Mr. Morocco, you mentioned $2,000 to $6,000 per year employee match. Is that just the match, or was that also inclusive of kind of models of how much of this $1,100 or whatever per person deductible? Is it just the match, or is it including the deductible expenses that the employee would incur?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, again, I'm not sure that I'm clear about the numbers. So when I referred to the increased cost in premium,
Mr. Chair, I made a note that you said that this would cost an employee match. So the cost of the employee would be somewhere between $2,000 and $6,000 a year.
Mr.
Morocco, whether that's just the match on the premiums, or whether that includes the cost of the deductibles as well in that number.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the broader range is anywhere between $2,700 and $8,500, depending if you have single or family coverage, and depending on how often you use the program. So if you are single and you don't really use the program, the increased cost to the member is about $2,700. If you have family coverage and you tend to use the program a lot, meaning you're going to hit that out-of-pocket maximum and spend your health savings account, then the change or increased cost to you is about $8,500. That includes then the premium and the plan design components.
Mr. Chair, so that's kind of fully loaded, all their money that they spend on inclusive of this kind of $1,100 average on the deductibles.
Mr. Morocco.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative, if you want to look at it just from a premium perspective, the range is $2,700 to $6,400, $2,700 for singles and $6,400 for family. So that's the increased cost on premium, and that's assuming you never go to the doctor. And then if you go to the doctor, then it's the additional ranges that I gave you, which is upwards of $8,500.
Representative.
Sorry, Mr. Chair, this is actually important because I think the perception here is that this is extremely expensive for the individual, and some of this isn't totally making sense to me. Mr. Mark, are there 50,000 covered lives or members in CGIP? Is that about right?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, I just divided your $144 million of booked savings, and maybe some of this gets booked not to the general fund or something, so I may not have this right. But that only came out to $2,800 per employee. That'd be, or per covered member, that'd be fully loaded. So I don't know, are there savings that accrue somewhere else, or am I going like this with you on the math here?
Mr. Morocco.
Mr. Chair and Representative, essentially, keep in mind that the first numbers are only because you're starting mid-year. So if you take an entire year, let's take fiscal year 13, the total savings is about $331 million. So that's the number on a yearly basis. Keep in mind, we run on a calendar year, not on a fiscal year. So that's why the first fiscal year, you're only getting half of the savings to the state. So if we look at a full fiscal year, the savings in the next fiscal year 13 is 331. So you need to divide that by the 50,000, And now you're somewhere in the $6,000 range per, on average, per employee.
Mr. Chair, can I ask, maybe it's Mr. Lundin or somebody, on the spreadsheet, the Senate is booking $144 million in savings, and yet that appears to maybe be, I'm thinking about a biennium here, obviously you're talking about maybe $500 million in savings.
Yes.
Where else are we directing those savings besides our budget?
Mr. Lundin.
The 140 some million that you're referencing is the general fund savings, and that is included in that language we were talking about in R19, the 302 million, that's one component of it for the Senate. But there is also the non-general fund savings, which Mr. Morocco did talk about there, and that we're not capturing to the general fund in any way. That would be savings that would accrue to those funds.
So, Mr. Chair, we've got
Representative Downey.
A few hundred million that has gone back to other departments or other budget accounts, and anyway, it now makes sense to me that we've generated your proposal has generated a ton of savings in other areas that aren't just in our budget.
That's correct, Representative Downey, and what we showed is the general fund savings, but you are correct on that.
Just a comment, and I know we want to move on, but I like where a lot of this is going. I think the ability of our employees to maybe contribute at a level that's commensurate with what people in the private sector largely experience is fair, and it's right, and it creates the right impression in the public's mind, and I think gives public employees a sense that they're being treated fairly as well. So I like the direction. I appreciate we got a long ways to go, and so Chair Lanning's suggestions about whether a total number or a plan design is the best route to go is something worth considering. But boy, that's a lot. That's a lot of savings that we're generating through this proposal that aren't even booked here. I don't know where that shows up in the Senate's budget targets, other places, but that's a lot. That's a lot of money.
That's correct. I'm going to allow one more question, and we are going to move on to the other items here, Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, just quickly, I think Representative Downey said right that we do something. Compare the private sector. I know the HSA, at least according to Senator Carlson, can be written for as low a deductible as $1,200 for a single, which means we may be able to do something where we maybe don't contribute to it, but we get a plan and they qualify and they can contribute to it. But I'm looking forward to future discussion.
Right. And before I ask Mr. Morocco just to touch base on R66 through 67 incentives for efficient use of SEGIT, just a quick response for Representative Downey. And I can tell you there are more savings. And I can also tell you that none of the other departments have taken these savings just because it's where you direct it.
Wow.
If we could just move on real quickly to R66 and 67. Mr. Shepard, do you want to make any comments on that, the incentives for efficient use of CGIP?
Mr. Chair and members, this was a provision that was, I believe, added as a floor amendment on the House floor, and it requires MMB to develop and implement program that creates an incentive for efficient use of CGIP and provides that the program it authorizes them to reward employees if per capita costs are less than estimated by the commissioner.
Mr. Morocco, would you like to make any comment towards that?
Mr. Chair, I don't know that I have any specific comments. I don't know the specifics of this proposal, if there was something very intentional in mind, but I'll make a couple comments. One, just from a very practical level, for us to be able to analyze a calendar year savings and then to pay it out by the following March is almost impractical. We don't even know, there's what's called in the industry incurred but not received. As you may have all experienced, you go to the doctor, it may take a month or two to actually get the bill and to reconcile all the claims. So it really isn't until May or June that technically we have finalized the prior year. So for us to be able to make a determination of savings by March is probably not realistic. But beyond that, I guess in a general sense, if we were to implement a program that we thought was going to save money, we would account for that in our premium rate sets. In some ways, to assume that you're going to save money but still charge a higher premium in hopes that you will then at the end of the year pay employees then some portion of that back almost feels disingenuous in some ways. So I can't, again, not knowing what the catalyst for the language was, I certainly understand the desire for wanting to, I guess, try to encourage or reward members for being more responsible. But that's sort of what we do through our plan design and in our discussions with the unions when we set forth and put forward either disease management programs or medical therapy management programs or whatever it is that we might be implementing. We account for that in the premium set in the premium setting with the full expectation that that's money that we are going to save, and we sort of book that savings right up front. So I'm not sure what exactly the program would look like, to be honest, but I'm not.
Thank you very much. We're going to move on, committee. As I mentioned, this has some pretty good ramifications in the total overall numbers, and once we receive some targets here, which will be coming soon, we could readdress that issue. So let's move on to R61, building efficiency. Mr. Bonner.
So, Mr. Chairman, on the bottom of page R61 on the Senate side, we'll see this begins, it's actually a series of proposals that are similarly structured. This one relates to state building efficiency and basically requires the Commissioner of Administration to issue a request for proposals that would require a vendor to provide a system that uses a series of a collection of building controls and instrumentation designed to reduce energy consumption, optimize use of space, and just generally improve operation of the facility. The language in Subdivision 2 is somewhat specific as far as what the system should look like, and this requires this is similar to some of the other proposals that follow. There's a proof of concept phase where the vendor is basically required to prepare a demonstration project to show that, and here it refers to 1 to 3 instrumented state buildings, and then that, if the proof of concept phase is successful, Subdivision 4 would require the state to go ahead and continue with the proposal, and this also is prescribed that, and I'm moving over to R62 here.
Correct.
The top of R62. This basically requires that the request for proposal dictate that the system provides savings and then payment from the state follows only after demonstrated savings. The timetable for selection of vendors provided for September 1st, 2011, and there's a reporting requirement.
Could you move on to fleet management and R62?
Certainly. Again, on R62, the fleet management proposal is similarly structured with regard to a proof of concept phase and timing and payment mechanism. This particular proposal basically relates to the state's vehicle fleet, and it's a kind of a comprehensive look at that with regard to energy efficiency, reducing maintenance costs, and lengthening the in-service life of state vehicles. And again, there's the selection vendor will be complete by September 1st, 2011.
Again, we're at a segment here where we won't be looking at making any kind of adoption, but if we have any testimony on this, please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kent Allen again, Materials Management Division Director from Administration. Similar to my earlier testimony, my comments here are related to sort of a technical procurement aspect of the provisions that Mr. Bodern was discussing. the Department of Administration very much supports the general use of data analytics in government. State agencies have already done some good work in using these sorts of tools, and we agree that more can be done and that there's potential for entering into very useful contracts with private sector consultants to do that. We also think there's potential with respect to developing contractual relationships where the payment is in fact linked to savings identified by the vendor. So my concern isn't really with the concept, but I do want to raise again some issues with respect to prescriptive language in the bill that we think puts the state at some risk. General language in the state procurement chapter allows the Commissioner of Administration the discretion to reject responses to proposals when they're not in the best interests of the state. The way this bill is drafted, it would rescind that authority and actually require the commissioner to award contracts in certain situations. Again, as I stated earlier, and similarly to what I stated earlier, one of the concerns here is that that requirement would be tied to a very legally vague criterion, and that is language in the statute in the bill that talks about providing material savings to the state. The state would be at risk of litigation with vendors if there was any disagreement between the state and the vendor as to whether material savings have been achieved. As I said, we're not philosophically opposed to the idea of paying a vendor from realized savings, but there are some complications related to that. One is that if that's the basis of payment, it increases the risk of disagreement between the vendor and the state agency. The vendor has a financial incentive to maximize the claim savings, and a state agency has a financial incentive to dispute that there were, in fact, savings. And a number of states have had contracts that have ended in disputes and litigation over the difficulties inherent in identifying savings and figuring out which savings are attributable to the work of the vendor versus the work of the state agency, or maybe just changes in market conditions over time. So we do have some concerns with how this was drafted. Again, don't have concerns with the concept. And for that reason, the Department of Administration has actually issued a very comprehensive RFP already to look for creative responses from vendors that would propose various uses of data analytics in government. What we've done is allowing essentially any vendor who believes they would have good ideas that could assist state government in saving money or being more effective to propose those in response to this RFP. And the interest that's being expressed is impressive to date. 62 different companies have requested copies of the RFP. 40 different businesses participated in a vendor conference that was held last week describing the process. So clearly the interest is there, and we're pleased that we're soliciting this broad array of vendor proposals. Another thing that we think is helpful with respect to the way this has been structured in our own proposal is that it really will allow the state to build upon the work that's already been done rather than start over or replace it in any way. State agencies will be defining their needs. The process carefully manages the communication with vendors to avoid any risks of organizational conflicts of interest. And the process that we have initiated eliminates the legal risks I mentioned associated with a mandated selection criteria, and one that's, again, somewhat subjective in terms of the concept of material savings. The RFP we put out also features a wider range of payment options. One of them is the one that you see in your bill, which is payment based on identified or agreed upon savings, but it also would allow payment based on time and materials and so forth if state agencies were to conclude that that sort of payment arrangement is in their best interest. So I guess to sum it up, we are think you have a good idea. We think there's the potential for vendor partnerships with the state that will prove beneficial, but we have some problems with how it's been drafted.
Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, when did you put out the RFP?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, roughly 6 weeks ago. I don't have the precise date.
Senator Gazelka.
I'm glad that you guys are taking our lead again. The permit process and you guys are a different department, but I think that's a great idea. It gives us the opportunity to work together, and I'm glad you're following our lead.
Any further questions? Representative Benson.
Hi, Mr. Chairman. In our language, when we say that we'd like for you to issue an RFP, couldn't you include the metrics needed in an RFP to ensure that it would prove a savings and cover all the issues that you might have about the legalities regarding it issuing the contract?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, the language in the bill basically says, in more detail than we're used to seeing in legislation, these are the specifications that you'll build into the contract, and if and that you will award a contract based on these specifications. And there could be instances where there aren't responsive vendors, there are vendors that have conflicts of interest, there are, going back to some of your earlier discussion tonight, vendors that refuse to sign up for E-Verify. I mean, we deal with those sorts of issues routinely. And the bill as drafted doesn't give us the flexibility that we would normally have to respond with common sense in those situations.
Representative Benson.
Help me understand. What specificity did we write into the bill that would require you to do something that couldn't lead to the result of a savings?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, it's the language that compels us to enter into a contract if
there's material savings.
If there are material savings, and again, that's a subjective concept, and the vendor could believe there are material savings, the state agency that they're working with might believe there are not material savings. And in either case, we've got a legal dispute, and we could be required to sign a contract with a vendor that in normal circumstances the Commissioner of Administration could conclude is not in the best interest of the state.
Representative Benson.
Could you not specify those exact things that you're concerned about in the RFP, though?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, I assume if this language passes as written, we would make our best effort to do that. But as we've looked at the language, we have grave concerns about whether the level of flexibility is there for us to successfully do that.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Benson.
Have you come prepared to offer any additional language? I mean, I've been talking with the departments about this for over a week. I guess I was hoping that by now, if there were concerns, that maybe you'd be ready to offer some language to help us work through. And I haven't seen any yet. So, and I know there are some other issues regarding the building analytics that I was more than happy are entertained changing, and have not seen anything from the commissioner yet regarding any changes.
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benson, the primary change that would assist us would be for us to have the flexibility that we have in other procurements for the commissioner to make a determination as to whether it's in the state's best interest to sign a contract.
Mr. Representative Benson. All right. Did I see Representative Downey with a hand up? No. So, Mr. Allen, it's kind of exciting to hear how many people are interested in that RFP. Any idea what kind of savings to the state will happen?
Mr. Chair, it's too early for me to to propose any number. I mean, we're optimistic about what we're going to hear from vendors in terms of their ideas, but we haven't even heard those ideas yet, so I can't tell you what I think that the dollar savings associated with those might be.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair, and Mr. Allen, I'm wondering, I assume you were able to conduct all these RFPs and now interact with 60 vendor inquiries and a vendor conference of 40 people, which must have been a big logistical challenge. I don't know, did you come back to the legislature for an appropriation to conduct that RFP activity?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, we're doing that with our professional technical contracting staff within the Department of Administration. And it's an immense effort for them, but it's one that was viewed as worth that effort.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, you said that you issued an RFP 6 weeks ago. What's the normal time for a response or for you to feel comfortable with the, or is there a deadline that you set with the RFP for people to get back with you and for you to have input and register their input?
Mr. Allen.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the due date on responses to the RFP is set for May 23rd or 24th, I believe. 23rd? Representative Benson knows this stuff better than I do. We've received over 200 technical questions from vendors asking for clarification of various points, and we've also requested a number of vendors have requested more time to respond. So the steering committee that involves agencies other than the Department of Administration that's working with us on this is meeting tomorrow, and one of the things they'll be looking at is those questions that have been asked, and we'll consider the request of interested vendors as to whether there should be some extension on that deadline.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Allen.
Thank you.
Let us move forward to R66. Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair, the House provision on R66 is section 57, lines 50.30 to 51.6. It requires the Commissioner of MMB to report to the legislature by January 15, 2012, on a process to redesign and consolidate the job classes for the executive branch with the goal of having no more than 50 job families.
Anyone would like to testify to this section?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is my language. I don't know how many of you would want to hazard a guess as to how many job classifications we have in the state.
Is it more than the agencies we have in the state?
It's a whole lot more. Would you believe that we have over 1,600 classifications and we have over 1,800 subclassifications? Now, anybody who's worked in human resources and personnel management understands the importance of having a classification system that is not so complicated and not so difficult to navigate and understand. And so when I learned of this, I was appalled when I heard the numbers. And I said, well, at the very least, we ought to engage in a study here to take a closer look at that in terms of reducing it. But how in the world can you get a handle on your costs when you have so many classifications?
I would agree. Anyone here to testify? Did I hear a motion, Representative Lanning?
I will move the House language.
Any further discussion? All those in favor of adopting the House language,
say yes or aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Yes. Let's move to R66 HAVA. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, this provision, Section 62, provides that if the Secretary of State determines that the state is eligible to receive additional HAVA money, the Secretary is required to certify to the MMB Commissioner the amount that would be needed to meet the matching requirements and the portion of that match that should be taken from an unencumbered general fund appropriation to the Secretary of State.
Thank you.
Ms. Frazier is here for technical.
Ms. Frazier, would you like to make comment?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is that House language, and we fully support it. It basically puts in place a procedure so that if the federal government appropriates additional Help America Vote Act funds, it allows us to take the steps necessary to receive them. And this language was in session law in the previous biennium. It basically just allows us to use part of our general fund appropriation for the required state match. It doesn't allow us to spend them, and it was added on the floor by Representative Kiffmeyer. We fully support it.
Any questions of the testifier? Senator Vandiver. Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair and Senator Vandiver, the R5 language appropriates the Help America Vote Act funds to our office. This language is different in that it does not appropriate any funds. It simply gives us the authority to make a transfer from the general fund to the Help America Vote Act fund to make the state match so that the state can receive additional federal funds if they're appropriated.
Senator Vandiver.
The R5 language actually appropriates the money. Is it appropriating the money that might come from us or the money that's already been?
Mr. Chair Ms. and Frazier. Senator Vandiver, if the R5 language were adopted and if there were additional federal funds appropriated and if this language were adopted, it would allow us to make a general fund transfer, would allow the state to receive the funds, and would appropriate them to our office. We don't actually believe that any additional federal funds will be appropriated, but it's nice to have this language in place so the state doesn't need to wait to receive them and can begin earning interest on them if they were to be appropriated.
Any further questions of the testifier? Is there anyone else here to testify on this? Any other?
I move that we adopt the House language.
Representative Benson moves that we adopt the House language. Any further discussion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carried. The last item that we have for this evening is R67 through 74 OET consolidation. Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and members, this whole article relates to consolidation of information technology systems and services in the Office of Enterprise Technology. The key language is on page R71. And that language provides that the Chief Information Officer in OET is responsible for either providing or entering into managed service contracts for 11 specified types of information technology systems and services to executive branch state agencies. It then, in paragraph B, provides that all state employees whose work primarily involves these functions are OET employees, although the chief information officer can assign an OET employee to perform work exclusively for another agency. The paragraph C allows the CIO to allow an agency to obtain services through a contract with an outside vendor when the value can be demonstrated. And paragraph D requires cooperation with the Commissioner of Administration on acquisition of these systems. There are also related provisions establishing an advisory committee, transferring duties, and requiring that prior to the transfer, the CIO would enter into service level agreements with each state agency governing the provision of services. This is all from Representative Downey's House File 191, I believe.
Do we have any testifiers for this evening? Any, if there are, come forward. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I can just provide an update because at our kind of first meeting run through, I indicated that I had had an initial discussion with our state CIO, Commissioner Parnell, who is here again. We have had another follow-up meeting actually just today with Commissioner Showalter and some financial people from, or a financial person from OET. And I continue to work on an amendment that I think is making really good progress towards the on the fiscal note, which I know is the chair's concern about the provision. So if it is okay with the committee, as compared to trying to act on this, I'd ask for maybe another day or two, and I think we'll be in a pretty good spot with regard to the fiscal note. I don't know if we'll be able to get a formal fiscal note back, but I think we'll have a much clearer sense from the department kind of where we're at. It is, I think, we'll make substantial progress on the fiscal note and clarify some of the assumptions going in that are probably helpful for the administration, too.
All right. State your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair, Richard Kajewski with MAPE. I would just, I guess I can really shorten this up. I know I spoke with Representative Downey on numerous occasions, and he has expressed a willingness to work with. Our only concern left in the bill is the piece that refers to the allowing of state agencies to outsource the work if they determine there's value and what the definition of value actually would be in those cases. So Representative Downey has said he's willing to work with us, and if that offer still stands, I guess.
Yes.
That's all I need to say.
Mr. Chair, the offer still stands.
Any
Mr. Chair, we would also, and I don't want to speak for Mr. Bergson, but we would also support the exemption of the retirement systems as well. I know Representative Downey's been spoken to about that, just on the nature of the data that they handle on a regular basis. So.
Right. Any further testimony on this? Anyone? Any further questions on this from the committee? Well, I would just like to make one comment on this. Representative Downey, I think you are spot on with this. I was excited about it, and I had originally picked up the bill to author it in the Senate, and I'm somewhat disappointed through my desire to have Senator Bonoff carry the bill because she has spent so much time on it. I relinquished my authorship and gave it to Senator Bonoff. And it is so disappointing that for some reason she did not move the bill forward in the Senate. And I am very disappointed. I don't know if orders came down for her not to, but I have had talks with Senator Bonoff and, you know, explained my disappointment that we didn't move this through the Senate. I can tell you on my behalf, and I think the Senate position is once you get to the point you're happy with, we are going to be excited to take this language. And I can only say I apologize to you that we didn't get it moved through the Senate, but you've done a great job on this, and it's the direction the state needs to go. So thank you for those efforts. Representative Lanning, it's your gavel next time. Where are we going to be? Outside in the warm weather?
Well, hopefully not in the hail.
Yeah.
Members, we're anticipating that we will receive our targets here hopefully within the next day or two. And we will not be able to meet tomorrow, I'm sure, given not only the schedule, but we still don't have our targets. So I would say that probably the earliest would be Thursday, and we'll have our staff in contact with your folks to determine the best time, and hopefully we'll be able to secure a bigger room so that, because on the next meeting, once we do have our targets, we'll start working on the numbers and our finance part of this. And obviously, we've got a number of other miscellaneous items that we've held over. We'll have to be taking those along the way, too, some of which we've held over because of not having targets, and others of which needed further study. So I've asked our staff to keep track of items that we have sort of put on hold or set aside for a moment. And hopefully, maybe when we get together next, we could have a listing, Mr. Botta and Mr. Shepherd, of those items. That would be helpful. So with that, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Being there's no further business in front of this conference committee, we are adjourned. Thank you all.
Good meeting. Covered a lot of ground.
So. What's that?